It's good, actually.
I just noticed I hadn't gotten
enough. Would you like to sit closer?
Yeah, I'm sitting here. I got to lose my bag.
You okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to offend anybody.
I wouldn't get too close to it.
I don't know if you want to sit by me.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we will open the House Interim Committee on Healthcare and open an informational meeting on an update on the Coordinated Care Organization Implementation Proposal, House Bill 3650, and I assume most of you know what that is by now. So first up, we will have Dr. Goldberg, Mike Bonetto, and Doug Elwell.
I know, thank you.
And you may proceed.
Good morning, Chair Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, and with me are Mike Bonetto and Doug Elwell, and we have some consultants on the phone this morning. We are going to really focus on two things. One is the financial analysis of the CCO proposal, and the other is some of the work that we've been doing that we've promised around medical liability reform and some studies that have been done. As just a brief introduction, I think as you know, we have been working on the implementation proposal. The board has met. We have another draft of the proposal that I believe legislators have gotten. The proposal, I think, now has the details and the specificity that people are looking for. We've been open for another round of public comment that closes today, and then the board will meet again on January 24th, and we'll have a final proposal to the legislature at the end of the month. The proposal as it is now really sets out a clear definition of what CCOs are. These are local entities that deliver health care and coverage for people eligible for Medicaid and individuals that are duly eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, that CCOs are a single point of accountability for health outcomes, and a single budget that grows at a fixed rate for mental health, physical health, and ultimately dental care. The CCOs will bring together new models of care that's patient-centered, team-focused. They'll have the flexibility within the global budget to deliver the outcomes expected of them. And finally, the CCOs will be governed by a group that's really stated in the statute that makes up a partnership between providers of care, community members, and stakeholders in the healthcare system that bear financial risk. The proposal also outlines the global budget, the accountabilities, and the application process. But today we're really here to talk about two other pieces. One is the financial analysis of this, and we're pleased to have with us Doug Elwell. Doug is been working with us for the last couple of months. He works with Health Management Associates. He's got a lot of experience in the health arena. He's been a hospital CEO and CFO. He helped develop the largest Medicaid managed care plan in Indiana. So he comes with, I think, a lot of experience, as well as his organization, in understanding the healthcare marketplace and what we can expect. And so Doug's here today to provide the analysis around the sorts of financial savings and efficiency that we can see from this new model of care. So with that, going to turn things over to Doug, then we'll do the liability piece, and then at the very end, we're going to spend just a couple of minutes around the ledge concept.
Good morning. My name is Doug Elwell. I'm a managing principal with Health Management Associates. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the study that we did and start right in with the methodology. From our perspective, what we did is we projected the enrollment in 2019 based on what was going on today and based on what Oregon had already projected the growth rates were, and also building in health reform in 2014 and the number of people that would add. So you have significant growth over the time period from about 550,000 to about 950,000 enrollees. We also, as part of the methodology, looked at the work that Milliman had done and extended what their analysis was for well-managed from just the population that's primarily pregnant women and children to other populations, including the disabled, the age-blind and disabled. We developed a range of high and low savings based on our expertise and what we thought could happen, low being very conservative, high being much more aggressive. And we have applied saving factor to current spending paired with projected enrollment. So we took the current spending levels that you're at today and those inflation rates and paired that with what the enrollment growth was in the areas. And so we came up with a number saying, if nothing was done, here's what the number would be, and then applied the savings to that. And then we also looked at a phase-in. We assumed that you would certainly not be able to accomplish everything in year one. And so we took what we thought was a conservative phase-in period of 10 to 20% in the biennium that we're in today to 40 to 50, and then eventually to be able to fully implement everything. The assumptions we made is that the utilization, again, we made based on past your current enrollment. So we looked at 2010 numbers that were fully there and looked at those. In that, and looking at the Milliman's work, Milliman kind of projected a 12 to 15% savings. When we looked at your expansion population that will come in with health reform, we looked at that same group because that group is a little bit like what we think or your current waiver population that you brought in is like a little bit higher chronic disease, especially among those who are non-caregiver adults. And so we modeled that population the same. We also then looked at your age-blind and disabled, and while that is a group that is a high-cost group, and there are certainly usually a lot of opportunities to save money if you coordinate their care, they also have some costs that are not conducive to be able to control. In other words, an individual with hemophilia, one of their highest costs is going to be blood factor. You're not going to reduce the use of the blood factor that much. And so when we exclude that, we took a lower percentage there and said we had an opportunity to save about 11.2% to get to well-managed. We then also looked at other parts of the transformation. And in there, we looked at integration of physical and mental health. And we looked at this as an add-on because really what Milliman had concentrated on was physical health and what it was going on in that system. And you currently have that in a bifurcated situation. We looked at the mental health preferred drug list. We know that's always a difficult thing, but quite frankly, a lot of states have moved that because that's a savings opportunity that's there that does not denigrate care. We looked also at program integrity, and that is something where we didn't expect that the new CCOs would continue to do audits, but they would understand some of the coding issues and some of the things that have continued to go on and be able to take out what really is a false cost that's within the system. And we looked at a variety of states that have done various things in terms of correct codings and edits and some of the things that the federal government is currently doing. We also then looked at primary care health homes, which is something that has been going on in Oregon, and you're moving. I think you have about 89 health homes right now that are in the certification process. And we looked at the literature that pretty much says there's quite a bit of savings there to achieve. And really, it's a net savings. And we used 4 to 7%, even though some of the reports were as high as 9, and we found individual reports even higher than that in terms of the ability to really have a patient-centered health home. And then we took a much smaller number at administrative savings from consolidating the MCOs and just said, you know, based on consolidation, you're going to eliminate some duplicate of salaries and some expense that are going into ICD-10. We've already talked about what we did in terms of phasing it in. And then, to the best of our ability, all these savings amounts are net. And we did stay away from a couple of other areas. One area that has a lot of promise is connectivity with the IT functions. We looked at an Oregon report and we looked at other things that said there's probably potentially a 4-to-1 return on money invested in that area. But if Medicaid was the only payer that moved in that direction, quite frankly, the cost to bring that up exceeds what you could save on the Medicaid-only side. So if every payer in the state brings that up, then it's paid for across the board. There is a return. But at this point, knowing that only Medicaid was here, we did not incorporate any of that because we couldn't get to a number that when we netted it out, it was not a positive number. So we put that aside, even though we think there's a lot of opportunity there. And we do believe there are federal grants right now that are available that many of the communities are going after. So again, if we start with the Milliman numbers, it was $118 to $141 million based on their report for pregnant women and children to go to well-managed. And well-managed for them is looking across the spectrum and saying if the system is well-managed, here's what you'd spend in these various utilization buckets. And there, I think, what we want to stress is this was not the best of each individual, the lowest each individual piece could be, but the best across the system. Because if you look at their detailed report, they actually, in some cases, suggested increased spending to be able to get to the overall lowest cost. We looked also at the dual eligibles. When we look at those numbers, and obviously they come out and look pretty big, but let's kind of take it back. If we look at 2010, your PMPM across your population was about $365. So if we start with that base of 365, in 2000...
per month, is it?
What? That's per member per month. I'm sorry, yes. Per member per month, it's $365, looking at the 2010 dollars. If we look at 2013, we're looking at, with population changes and stuff, we come up to about a number of about $374. Our low savings number is going to run, $394. Our low savings number runs about $374 on a PMPM basis, and the high savings number about $356. So you're looking at a difference of, in terms of against the inflated number, about $20 per member per month. Against the base number, we're actually looking at a slight increase. And we do know that many communities have already started savings activities, and so we picked up, although we show only 1 year, that they have the opportunity to pick it up over the biennium. So we know, for instance, in Central Oregon, they've started a number of initiatives that will feed into the savings already. And so every part of the state's at a different place, but some have started earlier than others. So if we go down the road, when we look at 2015, at that biennium, the inflated cost would have been up to $422 per member per month. At the low savings, we're still looking at $373, and at the high savings, at a number that would be about $335. So if you look at the per member per month, they look a little bit more doable, but they add up. When you're growing from 550,000 covered people to 950,000 covered people, and inflating costs that if you take out of the system this year won't exist to be inflated, you quickly get into the big numbers that you've seen in our report. So you're looking at numbers that show, you know, billions of dollars of potential savings over the time period. I will answer any questions or...
Questions?
If you were a betting man, what sort of odds would you take that these projections will actually come out in the neighborhood that year?
Chairperson Thompson, Representative Greenlick, if I were a betting man on the low savings, I'd take that bet every day. On the high savings, it really is going to come down to the system's desire to do that and what they see in it for them. I think that what you've got here is a situation where Oregon is removing some of the very serious barriers to being able to achieve this through some of the things you've done that have not been lifted in any other state that I've seen. And so if you're going to achieve this stuff, the first thing, I don't want to minimize this. This is going to be hard work on the part of the providers. So don't get me wrong, because this is literally transforming the system, not tweaking it. And in our country, you know, I was a hospital CEO for a number of years. I tweaked the system multiple times. I transformed it probably zero times, even though, you know, we looked at serious problems before. But this is a serious transformation. I think it's very doable. Quite frankly, in interactions with Dr. Robertson and Dr. Brown, I think you have the type of talent in this state to actually make this a reality.
Well, I asked this next question to Dr. Brown because it's very relevant when we met. These strategies talk about moving money out of the hospital and out of high-cost specialty care into primary care and primary care management. I understand how hard it is, but I understand how we can get money down to the primary care side. You talked about some of these things costing more money because there's... My question is, how do we get it out of the system once you've... I mean, how do we get it out of the hospital system, and how do we get it away from orthopedists, and which I assume has to happen, at least in a relative way. It doesn't have to happen in an absolute. How do we drain that money out of the system once we've changed the pattern of care?
Well, I think you've got, Chairman Thompson, Representative Greenlick. I think what you have is, and this is where the health home becomes extremely important, the system works on referrals and how that's done. So if you have a health home that is able to spend the time with the patient, make those decisions, it's the number of referrals that get made to the orthopedist, it's the number of referrals then they go on for surgery. Part of what will happen is the orthopedist will look, and again, they're dealing with the population in total. They'll change the way everything works. So say I'm an orthopod now, and today I'm getting 5,000 Medicaid referrals. Well, you know what? In the future, I may only get 2,200 Medicaid referrals, but every Medicaid referral I get will be completely worked up, ready to go. I will spend less time dealing with it in my office. We'll move it faster into whatever the intervention I have to make will be made. And so I may actually make more money per patient, but I will be doing less of a lot of things, and more of those things will be happening in the health home. So basically, if you look at the numbers, your actual spend, gross spend, isn't actually going down. Your population is growing, and so you're creating savings from that, and you're knocking down the inflation rate. So most of what's happening here is you're controlling your gross spend going on while population goes up. So if I'm an orthopod, I can still make a living. Now, I may not need to recruit 15 more orthopods because of the way this changes. I may recruit fewer orthopods because we're going to need fewer in that case. Now, at this point, no state has enough orthopods, so I don't want to pick on that group. But basically, that's fundamentally what's going on, is you're just using it less. I would expect hospitals down the road will actually probably be making more money, will get, be paying a higher rate per what they do, because we're going to take out all of the low, what I call the low-hanging fruit. So you're going to take out people who probably shouldn't be there. You're going to take out extra days. Well, those are less expensive for hospitals. So their rates will actually climb, but they'll climb based on the gain share from the overall system and controlling those costs.
One more.
Please.
I was looking at some data from a hospital in Oregon yesterday. And they, for some reason, were only collecting 22% of the true costs on Medicaid population. But they were collecting 185% of the costs on their private care. And they didn't seem to care, apparently. Okay, I can transfer those costs. All right, you take away Medicaid patients, I'll build a heart unit. Or I'll get two more MRIs or something. I'll figure out how to keep my revenue up. I'm afraid. I mean, that's...
Chairman Thompson, Representative Greenlick, I think that's absolutely been the way. It's the cost shift. It's the way it's been done. What this is going to do, though, is what this does over the long term is instead of getting 22%, I may be getting 45%, but I'll be seeing less Medicaid patients. So that my need of cost shifting is going to go down. My need for building new units and continuing to get larger and larger is going to go down. This is transformational. This will impact how many of this, that, and the other we have, because the economics will change. And if this system's adopted across the board, other payers, again, jump into the system, you'll continue to see transformation of the system, because we'll need certain things that we use a lot today, much less than that, and that's how the money comes out of the system. But part of the transformation and part of the challenge for the providers and the CCOs, and part of what you take away by taking away some of the antitrust so they can sit down and talk to each other, is what do we really need to be doing as systems, as a system of care across our community, as opposed to purely competing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Well, you mentioned earlier that we're doing some things not looked at in other states, and I guess I'm wondering, what would you think are some of the key features or items?
From my perspective, Chairman Thompson, Representative Kinnemer, what I see is the chief is you're taking away the antitrust. You're letting people sit down and work together. I think in going to CCOs, you're now bringing providers much more into the forefront of the effort, and it's very different if a managed care company is going to take money away from me by giving me a lower rate, it's much different if I sit around the table and look at my own organization and talk about what I could take out of the system and how that contributes to what we're doing. We're also, I think, for the first time, going to allow people to work to the highest level of their license. We talk about that a lot, but the reality of it is, in a standard system, what you're really doing is talking about working to the highest level of your billing capacity, because certain people can't bill. So if you're an RN, if the physician doesn't see that person, guess what? There's no bill generated. This, I think, in the CCOs, when they can redesign their own financial system, will allow them to make changes to it that will allow people to work to the highest level of their license. That, so those are the types of things that I see that you're doing that I think are extraordinarily helpful. I know there's other things going on. I know with medical liability and stuff that you're working on, that's also out there. But these are the critical features, I think, is letting the providers come together with other entities to do this work directly, getting rid of some of the antitrust issues that stand in their way, and really saying, I'm going to deliver this much money to you. You need to figure out how to provide appropriate care for the population.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to have Bill Wright is coming up from Providence Health System, and on the phone, I believe we have Kate Baker and Alan Kachalia. Dr. Kachalia and Dr. Baker from the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Baker is an economist. Dr. Kachalia, a medical doctor. They've been doing, as part of the team, working on some of the medical liability information that they're going to be presenting today. And I also believe on the phone we have Dr. Chuck Hoffman from Baker City, a member of the Health Policy Board, who's been very involved in all of this. So I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Wright.
Chair Thompson, members of the committee, thank you for giving us a few minutes to talk with you about the medical liability work. I am Bill Wright. I'm with the Providence Health System Center for Outcomes Research here in Portland, Oregon. And with me on the phone is my colleague, Dr. Kate Baker from the Harvard School of Public Health. And we were asked to put together a study on defensive medicine and overutilization in Oregon. And there were really a couple of things we were asked to do. First of all, come up with some estimates of the total cost attributable to defensive medicine, both across the Oregon economy as a whole, but then more specifically the bottom line impact on the Oregon state budget. And then secondly, come up with some estimates around unnecessary care and overutilization and what the key drivers of cost associated with those things are. So Dr. Baker will lead you through our approach to the cost estimates and the key findings there, and then I'll do the same for you on the overutilization and unnecessary care piece.
Hi, I'm Kate Baker, as Bill said, and our goal in this part of the analysis was to examine the degree to which defensive medicine could explain spending in Oregon in general, and in particular in the Medicaid budget that the state puts forward. The challenge there is that things like excess tests or excess procedures don't come labeled with a sign that says this test was only done in response to the medical liability system. So it's a little challenging to infer which care is really excessive because of the system versus necessary because of the underlying medical condition. So to do that, we drew on a broad literature that tries to really isolate the effect of the medical liability system on healthcare spending. And it does that by trying to strip away extraneous factors or confounding factors that might be driving healthcare use that might be associated with the medical liability environment, but aren't really a causal effect of medical malpractice pressures on defensive medicine and therefore healthcare spending. So we were very selective in going through that literature to really isolate what we thought were the best estimates of the degree of defensive medicine in the system. And then we took those estimates and apply them to Oregon-specific healthcare spending patterns, both looking at spending across types of care, like hospital care versus physician care versus pharmaceutical care, and also looking at spending by different insurance categories, Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance, and out-of-pocket spending. And before I give you those numbers, the one caveat that I'd like to remind people of is that these estimates are inherently somewhat uncertain because of that uncertainty about what share of spending can really be attributed to the malpractice system, and also because a lot of the estimates are drawn because of data availability from Medicare populations, so it's not entirely clear that those estimates port directly over to, for example, Medicaid populations, but they're just the best estimates that numerous studies have thus far been able to produce. So our reading of that literature and applying it to the Oregon-specific healthcare spending patterns suggests that about $650 million overall in the healthcare system can reasonably be attributed to defensive medicine that's driven by the liability system, and that's a higher share, around 5.5% of hospital spending, and a lower share, under 2% of physician spending, and we also apply that to pharmaceutical spending. Now, what share of that would then accrue to the state budget? Well, of the public spending portion, a good chunk is attributable to Medicare, which is, as you know, federally funded. That's about $162 million. Then there's about $30 million can be attributed to the state share of Medicaid and SCHIP. So that leaves about $30 million in the state budget that might be attributable to defensive medicine. That doesn't mean that the whole $30 million could be recouped if there were law changes. Alan and his colleague, Michelle, have worked on a piece that'll help you see what share might be brought down with different liability reforms, but something in the neighborhood of roughly $20 million of that $30 million might potentially be recouped if there were changes in the medical liability system. So that's a broad overview drawing on total spending data in Oregon and applying national estimates of the degree of medical malpractice. But those estimates then we tried to supplement with the survey that Dr. Wright will tell you about.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. So I'll tell you a little bit about our survey-based approach, and we use the survey both to supplement the analysis that Kate was just telling you about and try to come at some of the same questions from a different angle, different methodology, but also to understand overutilization and unnecessary care in Oregon and produce those estimates that we were asked to produce around that. And the way that we went about approaching that is that we went to the literature and we looked for a list of the types of care and procedures that have been most commonly identified with defensive practice, and then within the context of a survey, we presented that list to physicians, and we asked physicians to tell us, in each case, how many of these things did you order in your last month, and how many of those, in your best clinical judgment, weren't medically necessary orders. And what that enabled us to do was to come up with an estimate of the total number of orders in a year for each thing, and an estimate of the total number of unnecessary orders at each year for a thing, and we were able to multiply the number of unnecessary orders by the average cost of each thing to come up with a number that represented how much money was being spent on medically unnecessary care within each type of thing on our list. And then I rolled those up into categories so that we could see sort of the distribution of costs across different types of care. And what we really came up with, what really jumped out to me, is that the most common types of overutilization are medical imaging and unnecessary specialist referrals, which are 16% to 17% of orders, according to the physicians who ordered them, are being flagged as medically unnecessary. But that's not where all the costs are, where the money being spent. That's in the much more rare event of unnecessary hospitalizations and hospital care, which was 75% of the total spending attributable to unnecessary care or overutilization, according to the estimates on our survey. So most of the costs were in the hospital care. When you compare that to what Kate just presented, I think there's some interesting parallels. One of the parallels is that the analysis that Kate did on the expenditures data actually showed a very similar share of spending attributable to defensive medicine, 75% or so, being through hospital care. And that number works really well with the completely separate approach that we took to estimate spending using the survey data. We also came up with pretty comparable overall costs for Kate's number was about $650 million. We came up with about $750 million when we took our survey estimates and used the approach that I described to come up with the costs associated with unnecessary care. And those are $100 million apart, but in the context of $26 billion of spending, they're within, you know, 0.5%. So I think that increases our confidence that the right number is probably somewhere in that area, because we used two entirely separate approaches and came up with the numbers that looked pretty similar across both of those. So we found overall that among all of the things we measured, about 14% of orders were identified by the physician who ordered them as medically unnecessary. We also did a couple of things to try to make sure that our estimates were good estimates, because I think one of the real criticisms of survey data is that it's very subjective. And I think in the case of a defensive medicine survey, a good question is to ask, or a really fair question to ask, is are those really the medically unnecessary rates of care, or is that data kind of filtered through the lens of how salient this issue is to the physicians who filled out your survey? So we actually did a number of approaches where we embedded an experiment into our survey, and it was actually a pretty simple experiment. We just took we created our survey on defensive medicine, and we put those questions about overutilization on that survey. But we also created another survey that was a cost-effectiveness of healthcare survey that didn't particularly call out defensive medicine as an issue and embedded those same questions on it. And the reason that we did that is because we just wanted to be able to produce estimates of something that's actually happening out there at some knowable rate, and to know if whether the way you contextualize the questions or present the questions actually affects the answers that you get. And what we found at doing that is that we actually got the same answers regardless of which context we asked the questions in. So it wasn't the case, at least in our survey, that presenting the questions in the context of the issue of defensive medicine somehow resulted in inflated or deflated estimates of overutilization. And that tells me again that the numbers that we came up with can be fairly confident actually represent the real rate of overutilization among those services in Oregon.
Great. Want to turn things over to, I guess, maybe it might be a good point to see if there are any questions about the study, and then we can turn things over to Dr. Kachalia to talk about some of the recommendations.
Questions?
Thank you. Not being, you know, a real expert on this, it seems to me that when we talk about defensive medicine, it's overutilization of tests and this kind of things. Where does actual negligence come in versus spending too much money because you had seven MRIs where you don't need any? Is that a factor when you come to your conclusions?
Chair Thompson and Representative Doherty, I do think that it is a factor. And one of the things that we explored in the survey piece of it was trying to look at other elements of defensive medicine besides just overutilization. So there's another entire area of impacts that in the literature are called avoidance impacts, where physicians try to avoid certain types of high-risk procedures, or they avoid certain types of patients because they fear that they're going to get sued or for whatever reason. And we did find that there's plenty of evidence that that sort of thing happens in Oregon as well. And some of those estimates are present in the final report that we put together. So that is something that's also present. We actually found that that type of behavior is present among Oregon physicians, according to their report, a little bit less frequently than in some of the comparable studies that we've looked at of physicians in other parts of the country, but still pretty common type of practice. So.
And this is Kate. One of the criticisms of the medical liability system, and that I think Dr. Kachalia can speak to in more detail, is that it doesn't do a good job of matching up payments to cases of negligence. That in a system that was particularly well targeted, you would think that payments would be made to the victims of negligence and only to the victims of negligence. We see in the system in general mismatches of both types. Some victims of negligence don't get any payments, and some payments are made to people who were not the victims of negligence. That mismatch is probably a much smaller problem in terms of dollars than overall overuse of tests and procedures to avoid falling into the system. That doesn't mean that it's not a serious issue, but if you're looking at the budgetary implications, the excess use of things like tests, but more seriously of procedures, as Bill mentioned, is a much bigger dollar sign issue than mismatch of payments, errors where you're paying people who weren't the victims of negligence and failing to pay people who were.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think this is a really difficult area, and I just share a personal example, if I might. Last April, I ended up in the hospital with some chest pain symptoms, heart attack symptoms. And it was very interesting. I remember the cardiologist coming in and saying, you know, I don't think there's any reason to do angioplasty because we're going to find nothing. Your tests look good. Your blood levels are back to normal. Your blood pressure is down. And I said, well, you know, that was a pretty thrilling exercise last night. And at one point, blood pressure 210 over 110. And he said, well,
that's not good.
Well, I was hoping people knew that was not good. It was really interesting to me how much pressure I had to apply, because I said, you know, getting a pat on the head and getting sent home is kind of a scary proposition. And obviously I made the right choice, because we found two severely blocked arteries, and two stents were installed. I guess that's the interesting question here about when are you engaging in defensive medicine, or when are you doing exploration, or when are you being responsible, and when are you being foolish and squandering money? And I, golly, what a difficult choice. And I use that more as an example than you.
Yeah. No.
But I think that, this is Kate, I think that illustrates the real challenge here. In any individual case, a physician can say this seemed prudent medically, or, you know, it's unclear, but I left it up to the patient, and that's a reasonable decision for the patient to make. And there are, of course, lots of instances where tests that are used appropriately find something or rule something out, and it's very hard to say how much extra on the margin, what's the little extra push to do the test because of the liability system. It's very hard to isolate that portion from the vast majority, which are medically justified, and that's how we come up with an estimate that something like, you know, 2-5% of all care delivered can possibly be attributed to the system. We would never then say this test is medical malpractice, defensive medicine, and this test is medically justified. On an individual basis, it's, you know, you're splitting hairs, but looking at the aggregate, you can get kind of a rough idea of the magnitude. But that's why we wanted to emphasize the uncertainty of that estimate.
Sure.
Please.
I'm intrigued with your numbers of 2-3%. We've heard, actually, in these committees, the claims that defensive medicine is 25-30% of all healthcare costs. Never believed it. Didn't make any sense to me. But I guess I'd ask both of you: how come your number, 2.6-3%, is so wildly different than the claims we've heard? We've actually incidentally heard both the cost of defensive medicine is about 25% of the healthcare cost, and the cost of administration is about 25% of the healthcare cost. So it led me to believe half of all healthcare spending can be eliminated in some magical way. But your numbers don't. I guess I'd ask both of you, what's the difference between WAGs that we see of 25-30% in your numbers?
Representative Thompson, or Chair Thompson and Representative Greenlee, I don't know, I can't speak to where the number of 25% came from or where that one came from, but I think that one of the things I like about the numbers we produced is that we took two completely disparate approaches to estimating the cost of defensive medicine with entirely different methodologies and came up with very similar answers. And we didn't try to coordinate to do that. We actually sort of worked independently and came to a very similar answer. So I actually feel pretty confident in these numbers that at least we're in the right ballpark and not in the 25% ballpark. I'm not sure where that answer came from, but I do like the fact that we were independently able to come up with comparable numbers. So I'll stand by these.
And I would agree that I have not seen a carefully done, peer-reviewed estimate in the neighborhood of 25-30% based on a plausible analytical strategy. I don't know the strategy used to produce the numbers that you're talking about, of course. I can speak more broadly to the risk of just looking out at the world and seeing what's the medical liability environment and how much health care, how much is spent on health care in that environment? So if you compare two states, one of which had a cap on damages and one of which didn't, and said, wow, the state with the cap on damages spends less on health care than the state without the cap, therefore the cap caused a reduction in spending, that would not necessarily be a justified conclusion because lots of other things might be different between the two states besides the cap on damages. Maybe the state that implemented the cap on damages also had a very different population profile or illness profile or a different set of physicians practicing or a different healthcare coverage environment in their public insurance programs. Lots of other things could be different. So it's easy to find comparisons that produce a wide range of numbers, but it takes a more sophisticated statistical approach to be able to make the claim that you've connected the causal effect of the liability environment, legal environment, or medical malpractice pressures on healthcare spending. And we tried to be selective in our reading of the literature on that, and obviously we can't speak to that particular number that you produced without looking at the methods.
One of the issues that parallels this that I've been very interested in, it's not typically malpractice, but it certainly speaks to possibly overutilization. That's what I refer to as disease du jour. It wasn't that long ago that a huge number of school children were being treated for ADHD, and that was just, the numbers were just going astronomical. We seem to have cured that disease, and it's not very common anymore. Lately, it seems to be sleep apnea. I'm seeing numbers just going through the roof for diagnosis and treatment of sleep apnea. And that's a very expensive proposition. And it triggers a thought process in me because I have six friends who are all diagnosed with sleep apnea and hooked up to various pickup loads of breathing devices. And they're all very, very overweight. And I think there are pretty clear studies that show that overweight men have a tendency towards sleep apnea. And is there any way to get at that kind of data? Can we track diagnoses over time for growth expansion or retraction of numbers that might indicate overutilization? I think there's a lot of money tied up in that kind of thing. And I'm not sure what drives it, but on a population basis, except for discovery of a new treatment or a new disease, there shouldn't be big spikes in treatment modes. It should be pretty much level, I would think.
Chair Thompson, I think that... Oh, go ahead, Kate. I'm sorry.
Sorry, you're bringing up a lot of interesting and important issues in that question that are obviously a little further afield from the study that we did in particular, but important to the healthcare system.
I spend most of my time in the weeds, so that's not unusual.
Well, the big picture issue that I think is key is the role that chronic disease and disease management plays in driving healthcare costs, and there are a lot of studies investigating the effects of rising obesity, diabetes, heart disease on a wide range of healthcare expenditures, and those are clearly the long-run drivers of increases in healthcare spending in a lot of different domains. That's not something that we can deal with in this little bit of time that we have. In terms of increasing treatments for specific manifestations of those rising disease burdens, you're right that there are a couple of different things going on. There's an increased underlying prevalence of some things, but then there's an increased propensity to treat conditional on that prevalence. And that increased propensity to treat could be a good thing if new treatments are being developed that weren't available before that are now effective, or if things were going undiagnosed that were causing long-run health problems that are now being caught and treated successfully, that would be a good use of healthcare. If the treatments on the margin are not actually producing health benefits, then that's overuse, and you think that those resources could be better devoted to other types of care. The evidence from the geographic variation literature suggests that in some parts of the country, we're doing a lot too much of some stuff and too little of other stuff, and it's a very complicated pattern that's not easily pinned down to saying, we're just overusing these things. And that's a longer question than I think you want us to expound on right now, but I would love to think with you in the bigger picture about ways that disease management in Medicaid in particular could be managed more cost-effectively to reduce long-run healthcare expenditures.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Question that goes a little bit to the methodology. I hear a lot of complaints, particularly around seniors, of duplication of services. So they might get diagnosed or have an MRI at one place, and then they go for service somewhere else, and they have to have the same procedure done again. And I don't know whether you consider that defensive medicine or not, because it's just lack of coordination, or they want to rely on their own equipment. So I don't know if those numbers were, if you considered that defensive medicine and those are in your numbers, or that's just a, you know, then of course the recommendation of coordinated care will help take care of that. But are those considered in your 2-3%?
Chair Thompson and Representative Kenny Geyer, I think that, so the way that we came up with our estimates, we asked physicians to tell us if they thought the test was medically necessary or not. So I think in the sense that given the lack of coordination between different elements of the healthcare system, I think it's pretty likely that, you know, the second physician who ordered the test in the second place felt it was medically necessary because they didn't have access to the same MRI that was done somewhere else. So I'm guessing that when they filled out our survey and we computed our rates of overutilization, that, you know, they probably put that as a medically necessary test and it's not included. And so I think that it's entirely possible that with the improved coordination of care that you guys are trying to move to, that some of that might be eliminated, and then there's probably some opportunity to get additional savings out of that kind of coordination.
And as far as the aggregate numbers, we were very specifically focused on defensive medicine in response to fears about medical malpractice liability exposure. So that type of duplication that we might consider wasteful, we were not attributing to the malpractice liability system in particular, that if there were a damage cap of a different form, we wouldn't do that extra test. Rather, the use you're describing sounds like something that could be addressed by better information technology and better coordination of care, and that might produce savings to the healthcare system. For Medicare beneficiaries in particular, those savings are likely to accrue to the federal government rather than state budgets. It's still a misuse of services, and there are obviously dual eligibles that have implications for the state budget as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one more comment. In part is one who lived through the tort reform efforts of the previous century in the legislature. It was a miserable experience, and as I used to tell my patients often, we don't get lucky enough to die. You know, a little humor there, but it was painful. And I guess my comment is, as I've been looking at your recommendations and your estimates, they are very modest. And I appreciate that, because I think the piece in the executive summary that I can relate to and that I suspect we will bump into in huge measure is that this process, quote, can involve formidable political, legal, and practical challenges. And I just think that's, having experienced this firsthand, I just think it's good we're not underestimating those forces. Those are terrific. I mean, in an ideal world, there are a lot of things that could change. But we need to keep practical and realize this is going to exist within the realm of politics and practicality and human error that we live in. So I thank you for making these estimates small. I agree with Dr. Greenlick. I think there have been times that these have been highly exaggerated, and we have some great examples of foolishness. On the other hand, we have other examples where, well, enough said. Thank you.
That's probably the perfect lead in to Dr. Kachalia to talk very briefly about, given all of this information, what are some of the potential policy recommendations, pros and cons. So, Dr. Kachalia?
Hi, my name is Alan Kachalia, and what I'll do is I'll briefly review evaluation of 5 potential reforms that Oregon is considering with regard to medical liability reform. Michelle Mello, who's a professor and a researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health, and I prepared this report together. She and I are both also attorneys. So as we understand it, one of the main focuses of this transformation initiative is cost containment. And if you're looking at liability reform, there's two routes by which liability reform might help with containing costs. The first is one that we've been talking about quite a bit, which is reducing defensive medicine. And the second is to create conditions for insurers so that they may reduce malpractice insurance premiums with the hope that these savings will get passed along to providers, who in turn will pass them along to patients through lower prices for healthcare services. So we were asked to evaluate 5 reforms. The first is non-economic damages caps. The second is medical panels. The third is extending OTCA coverage to providers participating in CCOs when they're caring for CCO-enrolled Medicaid patients.
OTCA.
The fourth is modifying Oregon's joint and several liability statute to help with CCO enrollment. And the last is an administrative compensation system. Michelle and I, or Dr. Professor Mello and I, used empirical studies and data on Oregon malpractice claims and malpractice insurance premiums to model potential effects of these liability reforms. And again, we'll stress again is what direction you're going with reforms depends a lot on what your primary objective is. So if the primary focus or the sole focus is healthcare cost containment, caps are probably the most promising reform of the 5 that I just mentioned. But we actually concluded that their effects would be fairly modest and would involve inequities to certain types of patients. So to briefly summarize our evaluation of caps, what we found is studies show that caps have a statistically significant effect on indemnity payments, malpractice premiums, and physician supply in rural areas. They will actually lower indemnity payments and lower premiums and increase physician supply in rural areas, but the effect sizes here are small. We actually believe the effect of caps will be smaller in Oregon than we've seen in other states because Oregon already has some types of caps in place, for example, the OTCA and a $500,000 cap on wrongful death or prenatal or birth injuries. As a result, we estimated that there would be modest savings on indemnity payments, estimating around $15 to $32 million over 5 years. And again, this savings on premiums would come at a cost because caps will disproportionately burden the most severely injured and the elderly. The last piece is that even if you were able to lower indemnity payments, it's unclear how long it would take for insurers to pass this along to providers and how long it would take to get passed along to patients. So if I turn to the other reforms here, we concluded that medical panels, OTCA reform, and joint and several liability JSL reform are not likely to be very promising as cost containment mechanisms. And this is for a number of reasons. One is the studies of medical panels have pretty uniformly found that they're not effective with regard to reducing liability costs, reducing the number of claims you see, or affecting other key outcome measures. One small study did find a small effect on reducing defensive medicine practices in obstetrics, but again, that was one study. With regard to OTCA coverage extension, based on how it was proposed, which is providing coverage to providers when they're taking care of Medicaid patients in a CCO, we found that this may result in some financial savings for insurers, but they may not pass it along to providers. And this is for good reason. It's because it may be actuarially very difficult for them to pass along the insurance savings when it's only a small number of providers' patients that would, for which a provider would enjoy these protections. And it would also be impossible for the insurer in advance to estimate how many patients a provider would have that would enjoy this type of protection. So for this, we concluded it would be very difficult for OTCA coverage to result in financial savings for providers. Moreover, if you look at OTCA protection and joint and several liability reform, the benefits are actually going to be quite limited because very few claims in Oregon seem to settle in excess of providers' typical policy limits of about $1 million. There were only about 34 claims over 5 years in the National Practitioner Databank that settled above policy limits. We should also point out, though, that this does not inform on what happens with claims against institutions because those tend not to make their way into the databank. We also point out that OTCA coverage extension will involve an additional investment from the state in terms of providing insurance coverage in these claims, although it's probably meant to be a very small number of claims, estimated to be about less than 15 a year. And last but not least, we thought that OTCA reform would very likely not decrease defensive medicine because most of a provider's patients will not be subject to this OTCA coverage. It would only be a small number of patients in the panel. So as a result, when a provider's taking care of patients, he or she may not know which patient there is protection for afforded for at the point of care. So based on this, we concluded that if the focus, however, is broader than cost containment, and if the legislature is actually considering improving the liability system's performance and improving safety, administrative compensation is probably the most promising option. It's also probably the most transformative option. It's important to note the other forms that I just covered don't address the fundamental performance issues with the system. And ACS, however, may or may not be cost saving with regard to direct liability costs, but it may decrease defensive medicine, but again, this is unproven. System costs, including liability costs, may be controllable in ACS through various design decisions, such as what types of damages will be covered and what limits there will be on damages that patients can recover. More importantly, ACS may cover other benefits, may carry other benefits that these other four reforms didn't have, which is compensating patients much more quickly, improving patient access to compensation due to a broader compensation standard, reducing the litigation and liability-related adversarialism and stigmatization of providers that exist, and may actually lead to better information around improving patient safety. But again, an ACS will come with big political and legal challenges. And with that, I'll stop and open up for questions.
Any questions? Hearing none. Okay, thank you.
One last piece is the LEDGE concept.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Mike Bonetto with the Governor's Office. I will be brief. In front of you, you have LC 97. I just want to make sure we can just quickly walk through this so we're all on the same page. There were some pieces that were added based on some legislative input, and I just want to make sure we highlight that. As we've mentioned before, if you just quickly can walk through this, on page 1, section 1, this is just outlining that the legislature approves the proposal that's in front of you. And that proposal is what Bruce was just highlighting, kind of this update implementation proposal. So in section 13 of House Bill 3650, there is a long list of all of those requirements of the global budgeting process, the CCO criteria, the financial reporting. All of that really is captured within this proposal. So that's the first action in terms of what this bill does, is really allowing you to take that formal formalized approval. If you look to page 5, section 6 at the bottom of page 5.
I think the document we have in front of us is 286.
It's mirrored.
Which is the same as...
Thank you. I
286.
Is that correct? 286?
I think it's...
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair Thompson, committee members, right? We do have we have two LCs. We have LC 286, which I believe is a committee bill, and LC 97, which is a governor's bill. So, but they are, I believe, mirror. They're identical. I can continue on page 5. This is just a cleanup language that allows the Department of Consumer Business Services to share data with Oregon Health Authority on the financial reporting side. So that was a technical cleanup. And then on page 6, this was based on some feedback that we've received from stakeholders and I believe from some committee members. Section 8 highlights some non-discrimination language and really, I think, cleans up some specific existing statute and then just clarifies coordinated care organizations, that they would be required to the same standards that currently exist today on the non-discrimination piece. The last piece on section, on page 7, section 11.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Let me ask a question. So
is this non-discrimination piece, most everybody signed off, or I heard that there were still significant differences of opinion,
Chair Thompson, Representative Kinnemer, I think that we certainly have been working with stakeholders. I think there have been a number of versions out there. Mm-hmm. What we have tried to do is keep this as simple as possible, saying we want to maintain the current statute as is. And if there are, I think what we've been waiting to hear from others, what changes would they recommend to existing statute? So we basically take existing statute, tap CCOs onto them to make this doable.
Thank you. I believe you are correct. As of yesterday, there are questions about this particular language. So.
It's my understanding.
Is this different than any willing provider language?
Chair Thompson, Representative Greenlich, my understanding of that is the language that exists today for non-discrimination in Medicaid law is the same that we're saying. So that has not changed. The only thing that we've done is included CCOs along with managed care organizations.
So if a CCO member, say a chiropractor or a physician or something is doing things that the CCO doesn't like, they can't refuse to have that person as a part of their network? Is that what this says?
Chair Thompson, Representative Reed, they can. There are certain standards in place from a CCO perspective or managed care organization, and that provider is not meeting them, then they can.
It's not any willing provider.
Representative Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think the concern is that if we're not careful, we can have a token participant from a different kind of practice and exclude the general group. And I think that's the language that will be essential for some of us.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm intrigued with this line 20, preclude the plan or organization from using different reimbursement amounts for different specialties or different practitioners for the same specialty. So they'd have to pay nurse practitioners the same amount they'd have to pay primary care doctors under this. Is that?
Chair Thompson, Representative Greenlich, yes. And I would just, again, I want to reiterate that this is existing language. This is the only thing that we've done is included the CCO. So if you see on line 20, preclude the plan or organization, the organization is referring to coordinated care organization. So that is language that currently exists today.
If it's language that currently exists in statute, isn't that usually in the statute in the proposal?
If you look on section nine is basically clarifying that and allows that you'll see the deletion of a plan that is already existing language. And then section 10 outlines that language would then go, the reference to managed care plan would go away July 2017, and it would just be encompassing coordinated care organizations.
In the language it says that if the CCO is going to not have a certain provider in their group, they have to provide written reasons. Is there any standard for those reasons, or just we don't like you?
Chair Thompson, Representative Dory, I will actually defer
to my
colleague to my right, since he actually deals with this more than I do.
Puns.
That is a pun.
Chair Thompson, Representative Daugherty, I don't believe so, but let me get back to you on that.
Because I think that would be an important aspect to some of the alternative medicine providers that want to be included in CCOs, that there be some sort of a standard for refusal, mm-hmm. Especially if they still have their practices within the scope of right. Whatever the procedure or the practice is.
Which is reasonable. Although I think what we're trying to do is to be able to allow the providers in a particular community to find their own particular equilibrium and what works best in that community.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Thompson-Doherty, the other point that I would make is that this did come up at the last Health Policy Board meeting, and what the board has asked staff to do was to do a side-by-side comparison so we understand what is current language in Medicaid law in Oregon, understand what is new Affordable Care Act language, and then what any other stakeholders are proposing. So we can have a side-by-side analysis and then have a bigger discussion. That will happen next Tuesday's board meeting, and if there's any kind of recommendations, that will then obviously get inserted into this as well.
Okay, thanks.
The last piece that I would just highlight is page 7, section 11, and this is based on the input that we received at the last meeting here, is that there will be ongoing reporting from the Oregon Health Authority back to the legislature on a quarterly basis.
Can I ask a general question?
You certainly can.
I'm intrigued with page 15 of your report, the implementation proposal, and it in the second paragraph under coordinated care organization certification process, it seems to say that you will promulgate fixed criteria against which to measure CCOs. That I had heard there was some discussion at the policy board meeting about having that as recommended rather than mandatory. Are you coming down with the mandatory? Says he, hopefully.
Good.
Chair Thompson, Representative Greenleck, I guess I would characterize the discussion at the board meeting as the board grappling with how prescriptive they would be in putting forward this report, with the understanding that I think when we get to the rulemaking process and the application process, that indeed there will be much greater specificity in the criteria, so that we as the agency will be able to spell out the specific criteria that this does refer to.
Mr. Chairman, I fell. And I know we have a time problem here. We're getting close. I have worried in the past in this hearing that these criteria will not be available until we pass the LLC to give you the authority to move ahead, that they're going to be administrative, and you've heard me say I'm not crazy about that. Now, I'm particularly not crazy about the notion that the criteria, for example, what governance means and other kinds of things, will be able to vary according to the communities or according to the organizations that are applying. I mean, if that's the case, it makes me very nervous about the whole process. I mean, I would like some assurance that there will be criteria promulgated, and that while an organization might ask for a waiver of one or another along the way, that basically the criteria will be universally applied, so that anybody that meets those criteria can become CCOs, but people that don't can't become CCOs.
Chair Thompson, Representative Greenleck, I think I can provide you with that assurance that there'll be that specificity. And I think there's been some confusion, quite frankly, about the notion of specificity versus wide open criteria. Let me give you an example. I think governance is a great example, where I think it's very clear in the legislation and will be very clear in the criteria that organizations will need to come forward specifically and show how their governance meets the three issues, how their governance shows that it represents the major providers of healthcare, how it represents those who take risk, and how it represents community members. That'll be very clear. Now, having said that, where there will be less rigor is one organization may have a 12-member board of directors that has six from this and three from that, and another one may choose to come forward with 15 or 18. That's where there's going to be flexibility.
I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah.
But such things as what's risk, for example? Does an organization mean they're really at risk of the whole global budget? I mean, those kind of things, it seems to me, need to be very explicit. And they would, you know, in one place it might be the hospital that picks up the risk, in one place it might be the insurance company, in one place it might be you as a private citizen picking up the whole risk from Multnomah County or something. But it ought to be explicit as what that risk really means, and that's what I hope we can have confidence that the administrative rules will do.
Chair Thompson, Representative Greenlick, it's our intent to have that kind of explicit nature to the criteria and then how they're applied, some ability for communities to have those criteria fit them, but the criteria will be explicit. Yeah. And they need to be, because this is exactly what, we've been through a process for the past year of all coming to a consensus about what this will look like, and the criteria need to express that.
Chair Thompson, Rich Green.
I don't think we have achieved consensus on that.
Coming to consensus.
The other piece that I would add, and I think we talked about it at the last hearing, was just making sure that there is even some discussion, I think, from this committee on Appendix D. I mean, Appendix D, I think, does get to a certain level of specificity around CCO criteria. So I don't want to leave that out. I mean, I think there has been a lot of due diligence of a lot of specificity, and I think that specificity then would be handed off to OHA to then go into even probably a deeper level in administrative rule.
A long way to get to Appendix D.
I am suspecting that we aren't exactly there yet with this LC, because there are a lot of people that have concerns as of yesterday that voicing them. I'm sure that's not a surprise, but I would not be surprised to be now February to see some changes come down yet on this. But it's a lot of people have strong opinions about this.
Chair Thompson, I think we've always seen the LC as a place to start.
Yeah.
And I think throughout this entire process, it's been one of working through the issues as they come along. And certainly, you're referring to the non-discrimination piece in particular,
that's one of,
I think it'd be a great thing to sit down and to talk about what some of the potential alternatives are to the language here. This was a great place to start.
On that particular issue, there is real concern from a number of practitioner groups about the potential for being either left out or underfunded at the whim of a CCO. And we've had this conversation before, but I'm kind of drifting toward, we have in statute a list of professions that are considered healthcare providers in Oregon, and it seems one way to go is to make sure that we recognize all healthcare providers in this system, since we've also established their practice standards and whatnot in rule, if not statute. But it still precludes, the witch doctor from hooking a black box up to earlobes, because that's not a procedure that we cover. And I would hate to see this come down to a war between various specialties as to who is covered by this program and who's left out of it.
I think the focus needs to be on the outcomes, not on the coverage and the billing. And I think if we can, as a state, focus our efforts on assuring that CCOs get the outcomes that we want, that they'll use, hopefully, what are the best providers available in that community to achieve those outcomes.
We also have a tremendous increase in enrollment coming at us, and we don't have primary care providers that are going to be able to cover all of this without restricting access, which is exactly the wrong direction to go. So we may have people, doing primary care workups that traditionally have not done that, but it comes down to pushing people to the top of their license, and if they are capable and trained to do it, why not? As opposed to you've got to run everything through an MD or something like that. There's some legitimate discussion yet to be had there. Senator Kennebar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. As one has been involved in this for a long time, I want to say thanks. I think, you know, we still have points of contention and perhaps always will to some degree, but I am amazed at the long hours, the transparency, and the inclusiveness of the discussion to date. And some emails I receive at bizarre hours and on days off, including from you.
No, he has a program that takes the time.
Oh, it takes. Thank you for enlightening me. I was.
You can always count on Dr. Greenlick to.
That's good. I was falling astray. I appreciate the wisdom. But anyhow, and was duped. But I do need to say, I just think, you know, we have come light years here. There are some difficult hurdles yet to climb.
Yeah.
And some of us will be obstacles rather than aids, perhaps, at moments. But I just, I think it's commendable. And I'm still a little scared to call it transformation, but it's beginning to have some appearances of that in my mind. And
thank you very much. Chair Thompson, just one last quick comment. I just want to make sure that I'm circling back even on this non-discrimination piece. Make sure that we're clear. I think, you know, as Bruce was highlighting, I mean, this really for us is a starting point. And I think, you know, we did this, I think, somewhat strategically to use existing Medicaid language. And if there are providers out there who feel like existing law is not meeting you know, their needs, that's the discussion we want to have. So what can actually be changed in the future? I think I didn't want to put in new language that would kind of throw everybody off. Let's start with what we have and then figure out what needs to change.
And probably a lot of this is overkill, but we're moving into a whole new realm. And if we don't, out of the starting gates, establish trust throughout the system, we're not going to get anywhere. And so we're going to have to maybe push things a little farther, define things a little better than normally we would, but just to make sure everybody is feeling included and safe where possible. Obviously, we're going to have changes, but we can define those as clearly as we can. Anything else on... Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure we'll be talking again.
No doubt.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, next up, we have invited testimony on the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative, and that will be Dr. George Brown, Ed Blackburn, Cindy Becker, and Dave Ford. And it appears that we are one chair short. If it pulls up, please do. If you could keep your presentation to a total of about 10 minutes, that would be appreciated, because as per usual, we're running behind already. So I'm sure we're going to deal with this again in February.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is George Brown. I'm the president and CEO of Legacy Health. And joining me this morning is Cindy Becker from Clackamas County, Ed Blackburn from Central City Concern, and Dave Ford from CARE Oregon. It's our pleasure to give you a brief overview this morning of what we've done in the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative, and we welcome your questions. So why are we doing this? Well, the current system, as everybody agrees, is fragmented, it's inefficient, difficult to navigate, and oh, by the way, it's also pretty expensive. What we hope to accomplish is to develop a unified regional system of integrated care that addresses medical, dental, behavioral, mental health and addictions, health, social service needs of the members of the Medicaid members of the community, and the high-risk uninsured. We also want to find ways to make the risk and responsibility of caring for these patients equitable amongst the stakeholders. Just a brief word about who we are. We are a group of private and public organizations addressing a single complicated question. And that question is, can we together improve the quality of care and the care experience of Medicaid members and the high-risk uninsured, and do it for less money, and, oh, by the way, improve the quality of care that we deliver? Our group includes many competitors, but we are talking about how we might do this together, since we do have common interests and we also share risk. It's early in the day of our work, and there is a lot that we don't know yet, but one of the things that impresses me is the deep commitment that these organizations bring to the table to work through their problems. There are many questions and the nature of about what the ultimate organization will look like, how revenue streams will work, and many more complex issues that we have to work through. We have formed an executive steering committee composed of representatives of Care Oregon, OHSU, Legacy, Providence, Kaiser, the Metro Area Community Health Centers, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. We have also just added Tuolumne Health to the Executive Steering Committee, and we've extended an invitation to Family Care as well as Adventus. We have divided the actual work into several streams, a model of care work group, revenue development and distribution, startup development, and communications. Our group has applied for a $30 million grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovations that will help us develop this model, though we are committed to moving forward if we fail to receive that grant. Allow me to give you a sense of the progress that has been made and the level of collaboration that has occurred over the past 4 weeks. All of the aforementioned groups are meeting weekly, and the grant application is on track for submission on January 27th. We have had delicate and often difficult discussions amongst the diverse and historically competitive organizations to set us on the path of developing nothing less than a transformation of the care of Medicaid and the high-risk uninsured populations in the Tri-County area, which accounts for about half of all Oregon Medicaid expenditures. We're only a few weeks old, and we have significant challenges ahead with no roadmap to follow. There ultimately may be one CCO in the metro area, or there may be several. It makes no difference to our work, and we know for certain at this point that doing nothing is not an option, and we are committing resources and time to forging ahead. As I mentioned, this is a diverse group. We are pleased to be working with the counties, and I'd like to reintroduce Cindy Becker to you, who is Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County. I just want to tell you how exciting this opportunity is. A year ago, I don't think anyone would have thought we would be here now doing the type of work that we're doing together. And I think what we've tried to do is really look at how do we balance the diversity with trying to get the work done, with being transparent, with looking at the deadlines that have been imposed either because of the federal grant or because of House Bill 3650. And what I wanted to do is give you a sense of the various groups that are around the table, either at the executive committee level or in the various work groups, because I think it is pretty impressive. So the groups that have been involved are Care Oregon, obviously Clackamas County, Kaiser, Legacy, Multnomah, OHSU, Providence, Washington County, Tuolumne, Metro Area Community Health Services, Cascadia, Health Center of Oregon, Oregon Clinic, Central City Concern, Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center, Coalition of Communities of Color, Coalition of Community Health Centers, Oregon Primary Care Association, LifeWorks Northwest, Asian Health Services Center, Western Psych and Counseling, DePaul Treatment, Alliance of Culturally Specific Health Programs, almost done, Rosewood Family Health, Oregon Pediatric Improvement Project, Oregon Oregon Center for Children and Youth with Special Needs and Northwest Cardiovascular Institute. That's a lot of people. We're not all at the same table at the same time, but I think it shows you how wide a net we have been casting to bring people into the conversation, to get people to work together, to develop the various programs and models of care, and get the grant done, and to be able to manage that. Because again, you know, the grant, we just heard about the grant last fall. It's due this month. It's good, very competitive. I think there are 8,000 entities that submitted letters of intent, so it's not like, you know, it's a gimme. And so the fact that people have come to the table willingly and excited, back in early December, we called a meeting of every behavioral health provider in the Tri-County area, and they came without hesitation, saying, how can we be involved? So I just want to let you know that it's very inclusive and a wide group of diverse folks. Many, as was said, we're also very competitive with each other. The three counties are coming together. I think, you know, Representative Greenlick was very excited about that. We're working really well together, and we're very excited to be part of the process. The other piece is that we have plans now, as folks catch their breath around getting the application in. We are in the process of putting together communication groups, interactive communication groups, casting that net even broader so that we can have regular meetings with behavioral health providers, with technology providers, with primary care, with other groups that are involved directly and indirectly with the system. And then we also want to make sure that we're keeping everyone as informed as possible. We're going to create a website. We're going to be doing email blasts. Our goal is to communicate, and not just one-way communication, but two-way communication, listening, making sure that we're hearing from consumers, we're hearing from communities of color, we're hearing from a wide range of providers. And within all of this, again, we're talking, these groups came together 8 weeks ago. It's an incredible amount of work, and I said we are very excited to be part of it. We're excited to be partners with our other counties, but also with the private sector, and I think that we all have the same goals in mind, and there's a lot of things that we still don't know. We're working them out together, so I think it's a real testament to the fact that we all believe in going this direction. So with that, I'm going to stop a minute and turn it over to my colleague, Ed Blackburn.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. I represent the community health centers in the metro area on the executive steering committee. I am the executive director of Central City Concern, a nonprofit agency whose mission is ending homelessness and achieving self-sufficiency. And in that work, we have...
Can you state your name for the record, please?
Ed Blackburn.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. In that work, over 30 years, we have put together a coordinated system of care for homeless people that includes about 1,600 units of housing, a lot of that housing for people with mental illness and addictions, all very low-income people, employment services, behavioral health, very significant behavioral health services. We in the homeless population, see a lot of serious mental illness and addiction issues, health care and housing for families and services for families as well. We have, and in this work, we've worked with all the area hospitals and managed care companies over the years to help us build this coordinated system of care. So we have seen from our own personal experience in dealing with a high utilizing population the power of coordinated integrated care in reducing utilization of emergency departments, hospitals, psych units, these high-end cost services. So our participation in this from the community health centers is what I see here is an extraordinary effort. And there's a lot of hope, but as someone said, we can't afford magical thinking here. So it's going to be tough work, but I'm inspired to see the area hospitals and the managed care companies and all these community organizations come together, I think, in a very sincere effort. People have already put many hours into this, and so this is a real effort, and I'm excited, and I feel really privileged to be at the table at this stage in my career. Thank you. I want to introduce Dave Ford, the president and CEO of Care Oregon.
Co-chairs and committee members. I'm Dave Ford, for the record, CEO of Care Oregon. I've been at this business a long time, and this is the first time we've broken silos and worked as a community team in three counties. We've really treated this as the commons. The challenge that you, through the budget, through the legislation that you've cumulatively built over the years, has really stimulated a lot of thought and work. This is getting the work that you've put in policy down to the ground and down eventually to people and delivering care in a better way. And we're all committed to the triple aim: better care for less cost with better outcomes. And that's what this is about. And it's a remarkable effort. The magical thinking is material. We've been able to take a lot of core competencies by different organizations and put them in a common pool. Legacy, for example, has expertise in discharge planning. Prov is doing a lot of generative work around navigators for emergency rooms. Care Oregon historically has done a lot of work around primary care renewal and team-based care. And we're starting to see economic results after 4.5 years in the neighborhood of excess of 10% of the premium of those people that are in that those categories, which is about half of our book of business. The point that I'd make is this is really hard work, and it's hard work to take from ideas down to hundreds of doctors, hundreds of practitioners, and thousands of members. And so when this cascades down on the ground, it's big work. And so the idea that was presented that we're going to get these savings in a short period of time, really we need to be sober about that and understand we've got to invest forward, build capacity, and plan that out. And I think you'll see in some of our planning, and when we testify later, some great plans we'll communicate. So that's one message. The other message is transparency. We've been able to collaborate. We've gathered data with the state. We've protected HIPAA and so forth. We need your help to be able to share information among our partners and take out anything that might be prohibitive in the state rules, as well as advocate greater maybe some waivers in the process, so that we can, in fact, share effective information across our boundaries in to benefit the patient. So finally, we have not come to terms yet with what form this organization will take. We've had some dynamic, healthy, full of advocacy and opposition dialogues already around the form, and it may be a public corporation, and we'll ask you to help us just put that in the law to hold that open. We haven't made a decision. We could go to a 501c3 and make it a non-for-profit organization. We may do this through a joint ventures and bring the partners together. That has yet to be determined, and that will be determined over the next several months. And so we'd like you to understand our work, and that it's emergent, and that we're working on many tracks. We're working on a track relative to organizational structure, relative to shared services, and we haven't done this across systems before, and it's remarkable. And then when we get down to the microsystems, how does this go together on the ground with doctors and patients and practitioners and so forth to get a better system of delivery? So with that, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Questions?
Just a very brief one. What are the conditions under which you have a safe harbor for antitrust activities?
I'm not sure that we really have one yet.
Okay. I mean, you're not doing this under the state using the...
We have had a representative from the state. When we brought the MCOs together, a member of the Attorney General was part of that, and so we had the five managed care organizations meet for a series of months, sharing data and so forth. We haven't talked about prices and those kinds of things, which would get us into antitrust kinds of things. We've been very careful about that. But we are collaborating for the common good here.
But there is a way to create a safe harbor.
We think so, and we think that as we go dialogue further, we'd like in your policy efforts for you to create some protections for that.
And we've made the Dr. Goldberg and Governor Kitzhaber aware that this will be ultimately something that we will have to go forward.
Yeah, I don't think it's that complicated. You just have to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kenneman.
Thank you. I appreciate, Mr. Ford, your comments. It's been interesting to see this formulated, and as a former provider myself, I have quite a perspective about the silos in which we have historically operated. And it's almost unimaginable that there would be conversation, much less working together. So I think that's commendable. I want to say thank you, and I think it's amazing. And if we're really going to get anywhere, I think we all need to understand we're all in this mess together, or this opportunity, if I could. I don't know if I can get that positive yet, but I think it's amazing, and I thank people for making that effort and understanding and taking the risk, because I think we've historically viewed everyone as a competitor, and that they took away from us rather than that we add momentum jointly.
Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Kenmer. What Dr. Brown has said is we need to move from sort of design space into solution space, and we are in about ready to do that. And if you've heard anything among partners here and others, it's the enthusiasm that there is a remarkable pool of talent that has been applied here, and the people that are doing the work are electrified by being able to unloose and unleash or liberate themselves from their silos and begin to collaborate across the whole system.
Representative Ken Meyer, the driving force behind that spirit of cooperation is the recognition and the acceptance of the fact that the current system is not sustainable and not working, and that we're ultimately capable of doing better, and I think that's what propels us forward.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, another comment. It was really interesting to me. You know, we are headed towards a calamity, and it's nice to understand that. And the other piece that I think is interesting, the other day I made some comments, and it's also interesting, and there is no plan B. So hopefully we make this one work.
Mr. Thompson. And this has absolutely no relevance other than the fact what Representative Kenmer just said. I have a flashback to my sophomore biology class where words to live by, you adapt, migrate, or become extinct. And I think that's something when you look at the healthcare profession and what is happening with people not being able to access healthcare, not be able to afford healthcare, wait until they're so sick that they have to call 911. That kind of thing, I think, is we really need to look at, and I commend the transformation teams, because that's exactly what you're doing, and because you have to, and we want you to. So.
Yeah, I think you. It looks to me like you're on the right track, but I would urge you to redouble your efforts on communication, because that's the, we are asking people to accept massive change in the way they're doing things, and in your case, I know there are still people on the bottom that are curious about what's going on at the 30,000-foot level, and that generally, and I'm seeing it all over the state as I go out and talk to different people about transformation. You're ahead of the curve. Without the communication piece, that breeds distrust or more distrust, and at that point, you can't get cooperation. So. I think in all of these, we're going to have to really make sure that communication piece is solid. And, sounds like you're on a good track. But inevitably, there's somebody down there sitting at the street level who is wondering what you're doing, or if they're included, and that starts the battle.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I completely agree with your recommendation. We recognize that within the collaborative, and we have a growing list of stakeholders that we need to broadcast out what it is we're doing. We're fully cognizant of that, and the difficulty is the rapidity with which this process is moving and working through some of the complexities, but that doesn't forgive the necessity of making sure that we're completely transparent with our stakeholders, or else they will create difficulties for us because they don't understand what it is we're doing.
Exactly. That's the point. Thank you. Any other questions for you?
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Anthony Barron.
Okay, next up, we have an update on the Oregon Health Exchange Corporation. The Rocky King, Amy Faber, and Anthony Behrens.
I think this is...
facsimiles.
Yeah, right. Or anybody else who wants to fill in. If we're running far enough behind, they probably decide to go for coffee or something. You know?
There we go.
Thirty seconds away from moving on. It's good to be out here.
For the chair. For the chair.
Tempting.
For the chair.
Yep. Move this. Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. And with me this morning is Liz Baxter, our Board Chair, Amy Faver, who is the Deputy Director for the Exchange, and Anthony Behrens, who is a policy analyst on, Senior Policy Analyst on Healthcare with the Insurance Division. We're only going to take a few minutes of your time this morning because we know we still have some public testimony about the exchange that's to follow. Just to lead off, the board approved the business plan officially on Wednesday of last week, January 11th, and I think a copy has been provided to you. So Liz will spend a few minutes talking about the process that was followed in developing the business plan, and then we'll kind of come in and talk about some of the minor changes that were made to it since our last hearing. Liz?
Thank you. Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson. For the record, my name is Liz Baxter, and for those who know me in another world, today I'm here representing the board as the chair of the board for the Health Insurance Exchange and wanting to present to you the board-approved business plan. As a board, we've had six meetings, and probably the majority of the last three meetings have been spent revising and refining this plan. And we've gotten input from stakeholders, from the Community Advisory Committee, from public testimony, as well as from board members. And so Rocky and his staff have incorporated all of those changes, and I think later Rocky will be walking you through really the specific changes from the last time you saw the document to the document that you have in front of you. The board feels that this plan really lays out the foundation of how an exchange could work, how we can build an exchange that Oregonians feel like it's something they can rely on and something that they can trust. And that was very important to us. And with all of those changes, we did approve this plan to come before you, as Rocky said last week. So I'm going to just leave it at that and have Rocky go ahead and walk through those changes. Thank you.
So, again, for the record, Rocky King, Executive Director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. The changes that have been made since the last hearing, and I believe that was December 18th, are really come under two different categories. First, just plain wordsmithing. And some people call it document smithing, because we don't think there is a page of those 37 pages that we haven't adjusted some word, some sentence, some paragraph, someplace. Let me give you an example. If you at some point take a look at pages, I think 23, 24, 25 around the financial modeling, Representative Richardson really gave us some some really good feedback on how we laid out the administrative fee. And so we really rewritten that section, didn't change any of the substance to it, but just have used this as an opportunity to hear people when they would say, I didn't understand that. Is there a different way to express it? So we really wordsmithed a variety of different sections of the document, we think, to make it more plain. The second kind are really additions to the business plan. And an example of that is Representative Parrish, who isn't here, down in education, I think, wanted to make sure we had a kind of an outline that really committed the board and the corporation to monitoring the enrollment and reporting back to the legislature on a quarterly basis as to whether or not it was going to be self-sustaining in 2015, and if it was determined at some point that it would not be, what we would do, which is come to you and the governor with a variety of options for you to consider. So that was kind of the second category. Representative Greenlick also had, for example, a suggestion about dividing out what you can do today versus what you can do tomorrow. So we've started using the term phase one, phase two. You could use it kind of like software, version one, version two. And an example of that is in HSAs for in the individual and group small group market. We're going to put an asterisk by the plans that are eligible for health savings accounts as a health savings account if an individual already has one or wants to establish one. We're not going to set up that account for them. We'll provide the plan, but we will link them to the financial institutions that can actually set up an HSA. Phase two, however, we may be able to have people come on the exchange and actually sign up and do all the work right there in one place. So that's kind of down the road, more complicated, more difficult to integrate. So we've kind of divided that out. I think Representative Greenlick and Representative Richardson also talked about some quality issues that we want to build in measuring plans. Some of that we'll be able to do day one. Some of it won't be day one. So we've tried to make that kind of plain throughout the document. The board and staff really believe that this is a beginning business plan and a good start, that it outlines, you know, what the exchange is, what it can do, what its value is to Oregonians, and it projects or estimates the cost going forward, and really, I think, gives us a pretty good idea of what our sustainability, realistic projections on being able to be sustainable by 2015. So that's kind of just, there have been no substantive changes to the document, really clarifications and wordsmithing and adding things that we think make it more clear. So with that, I'm going to ask Amy to talk a little bit about the legislative concept that will be before you in February.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Amy Fauber. I'm a deputy director of Exchange, and I just wanted to say a couple words about the legislative concept that you'll be seeing next week when we introduce it. We don't have the draft back from Ledge Council yet, but we've provided a summary of it. It's in your packet, LC-161. As you all remember, Senate Bill 99, which created the Exchange as a public corporation, required that we present to you a board-approved business plan for the February session, and that business plan be approved by the Legislative Assembly in order for us to be able to keep moving forward. Our legislative concept that you'll see is pretty simple. As you know, the business plan here, all 35 pages of it, are something that we at the corporation will be going back to frequently. We'll be revising it. We'll be updating numbers as we get new information, as we get further regulations from the federal government. So we consider it a living document and not something that can really be put into statute. So instead, in order to achieve this legislative approval, the approach that we're taking in our bill is to simply delete the requirement from statute, delete the requirement that was in Senate Bill 99 that requires the Legislative Assembly to approve a business plan. There will be in the bill, when you see it, some more affirmative language in the whereases, whereas that we have presented this plan to you and whereas it has been reviewed and approved by the appropriate committees, yourselves and the Senate committee. So we're hopeful that approach will work. I also wanted to flag a couple of other things that you'll see in this bill. Two are very technical
in nature, and then a third that I'm going to turn over to Rocky to talk about. The first is just simply fixes an error we made when the bill was drafted. The Senate Bill 99 was based on the statutes in place for SAFE. And when it came to our banking relationships and our relationship with the state treasury, they were a bit outdated. So we have had trouble having an independent relationship with a financial institution, and the treasurer's office has asked us to make this change. So when we present the bill to you formally next month, we expect we'll have somebody from the treasurer's office here to talk about that as well. But it just simply fixes this error, and they had told us if they'd realized this language is in place during last session, they would have asked for an amendment at that time, but it missed their notice. The second technical fix is around our adherence to the public contracting code. The exchange, like other public corporations, is not subject to the public contracting code, though there are a couple places where we would like to be, because we feel like it would provide us a clear process. So, for example, when we issue an RFP and we have bidders, we'd like them to just know it to be very clear that this is the process that we follow, and it'll be one that they're used to following. So we'll clarify that we are subject to a couple of provisions of the public contracting code. And then there's a third piece that I'm going to ask Rocky to talk about.
The members of the committee, the third piece really relates to health benefits for exchange employees. And when the Senate Bill 99 was first passed, it gave the board the option of electing PEB for benefits for its employees. And the board did do that. We didn't have a lot of time. We were trying to hire people, so we selected PEB. In a lot of meetings that we have had with employees, though, we feel that we need to kind of walk the talk, that we're talking about coming out with plans for small businesses and the exchange in 2014. And so we thought that we would like to really use this next year to try to develop some sort of model plan that could be offered through the exchange, not by the exchange, by carriers, but be offered to the exchange, and test out some of the theories around defined contribution, where you have multiple carriers that are providing benefits to the employees. We thought it would be a good idea really to test this out and to model it, to take some risks and to see, you know, where the problems were. That would help in some of the design. So this really gives us the ability and gives the carriers the authority to do some things that will be maybe a little bit more innovative around not the benefit design, because we have to have the same benefits by federal law and state law, but around some of the issues around contribution or participation standards. We want to be able to do basically what happens in a large group market, where there may be some HSA options, there may be integrated service delivery options, there may be health engagement options, and we just want to take the next 6 months to see what we can come up with. That little two or three sentence line gives us really the authority to be the experiment in trying to put something together. So that's kind of all we have today on the exchange, both the presentation of the approved business plan and the legislative concept. Anthony Behrens is here to talk about essential benefits. If Mr. Co-Chairs, you would like him to proceed with that.
Please do. Enlighten us.
Okay. Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And as Rocky said to you today, I'm here to talk about essential health benefits and the guidance that we recently received from the federal government. I've provided written testimony, so I'll just kind of try to summarize that and hit the highlights. But if at any time you have any questions or want further detail, please don't hesitate to ask. On December 16th of last year, the federal government issued some preliminary guidance on essential health benefits, and I think many, me included, had anticipated that the feds would define and somewhat standardize the essential health benefits across the country. But what they did instead was they sort of left that up to the states, and the recent guidance suggests that the states will choose from one of 10 existing plans to establish essential health benefits, and these plans are referred to as benchmark plans. The selection of a benchmark plan for essential health benefits is important for a number of reasons. Under the Affordable Care Act, the essential health benefits package that is chosen will become the minimum required coverage in the state's individual and small group markets, both in and outside of the exchange. And although the feds have recently stated that they will issue separate essential health benefit guidance for Medicaid plans, it is possible, if not likely, that the state's decision on essential health benefits will impact the 2014 Medicaid expansion. In addition, as you all know, I think the states must defray the costs of any mandated coverage that exceeds the essential health benefit minimum for those purchasers who purchase through the exchange. And just as a little bit of background, kind of backing up, the essential health benefit categories that are in the Affordable Care Act, there are 10 of them, are ambulatory patient services, emergency services, hospitalization, maternity and newborn care, mental health and substance use disorder services, including behavioral health treatment, prescription drugs, rehabilitative and habilitated services and devices, laboratory services, preventive and wellness services and chronic disease management, and pediatric services, including oral and vision care. There are still a number of questions outstanding regarding the most recent guidance, but what we know now is that the federal government has identified 10 benchmark plans from which the state is to choose one. And so those 10 benchmarks are the following. The largest plan in each of the three largest products in the small group market, that particular phrasing is what comes out of the bulletin. It's caused quite a bit of confusion among the states. There are several questions outstanding regarding what is a plan, what is a product. From the information we have now, it appears that the product is kind of the services that are covered, and the plan would be the kind of the cost-sharing mix. So if, for example, let's say one of the benchmarks was Regions small group plan called Innova. So that would be the product, and then the plan would be, the $2,000 deductible 20% coinsurance. That would be the plan. And so the idea is that HHS will identify the three largest products, and then the three largest plans, or the largest plan in each of those three largest products. I know it's confusing, but that's the way it is. And the size is based on the enrollment. The next category of benchmarks is the three largest state employee benefit plans by enrollment. We believe that these are probably PEB plans, but there is a possibility that they may be OEB plans as well. We're trying to get some definition of state employee benefit plan. That's not defined in the guidance. The next category is the three largest federal employee health benefit plans, and those have been identified. The final category is the largest commercial non-Medicaid health maintenance organization. So again, this is another category that's generated a lot of questions in exactly what that means. HHS Health and Human Services has indicated that they will identify for the states the three small group benchmarks. And it sounds like, potentially based on the latest guidance, also maybe the HMO product. They will use the first quarter enrollment numbers to identify those benchmarks. When they give us those benchmarks has not yet been determined, so we're not certain of when they will tell us. By September 30th of this year, the state must make its selection regarding essential health benefits. If the state does not make a selection by that time, the default selection will apply, and the default is the largest plan in the largest product in the small group market. Other than to identify the largest plans within the largest product within the small group market, it appears that cost sharing, at least at this point, is not relevant. So, for example, in that Enova example I gave you previously, the $2,000 deductible, 20% coinsurance, that may be the largest plan, the most popular plan, but that doesn't mean if that's our benchmark that we'd be tied to those cost-sharing, that cost-sharing structure. We actually don't know what the cost-sharing structure would look like because HHS hasn't provided any guidance on that. They say that guidance is forthcoming, but again, we don't know when we will hear about that. The department is in the process of analyzing the guidance and along with several other states, as I mentioned, have submitted a number of questions to hopefully clarify the guidance. And we are working closely with the exchange and the Oregon Health Authority, including the Medicaid program, to develop a work plan for benchmark identification and comparison to determine the best way to proceed with our analysis. Because the decision around states' essential health benefit package has implications inside and outside of the exchange and likely on Medicaid, the department and the other entities involved believe that the selection process, whatever that ends up looking like, should include a public discussion and be transparent. And as we learn more and continue our work with our partners, we will continue to provide information to the committee as desired. And I do appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Any questions? Yes, no? I think you probably know we'll probably be inviting you back in February, right? Okay, thank you. Okay, next we have invited testimony from Laura Etherton, Gail Evans, Betsy Earls, and Jan Meekums. Could limit your testimony to 5 minutes, if you could, or round about that. We can stay on schedule. And if you would just please begin by stating your name, and you're on.
All right, Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has about 1,600 members across the state, and the size of our members pretty much mirrors the size of small and medium businesses across the state. So our the size of our businesses are pretty representative of, you know, the number of small businesses or the percentage of small businesses in Oregon. So we'll have a number of members using the exchange. AOI has been very appreciative of all the work that the exchange board and its advisory committees have done in creating this system, which is transparent and market-based and allows individuals and small groups the ability to make meaningful choices about their health insurance plan and find something that works the best for them. As the business plan's written, it allows for a competitive and innovative market with plenty of choice, which is important to us. And this benefits individuals and employers alike, and of course is a critically important issue, as I know that we've discussed in the past. AOI had several things that were really critical or key issues to us to make an exchange successful, and just a few of those, probably the most important, were that using the exchange had to be easy and understandable for employees, employers, and any unemployed individuals who were using the exchange so that they could make informed choices about the best products for their unique situations. Another thing that was key to us was that employers would be able to make defined contributions to the exchange and then have the exchange handle the details of making premium payments to several different plans, perhaps, depending on what employees of that employer chose to do. And a third thing was that we wanted people who were perhaps employed part-time to be able to aggregate contributions from maybe a few employers in order to purchase one plan. So insurance was more portable for people that didn't have a full-time employer and a full-time plan. And the way the bill is, or the way the business plan is written right now, it satisfies all those needs. We wanted to make sure that, assuming every insurance carrier meets minimum qualifications, they are allowed to participate in the exchange. And if that's the way things continue, as it's written, the choices that are available to our members and their employees will be meaningful, prices will be competitive, and we think that's probably the best market-based system or market-based approach to take. It's our position that it's not the exchange's role to choose or prioritize certain insurance products on behalf of business, but rather that more choice and decision tools be offered in place of that. The business plan elements that deal with small business very clearly articulate the vision that we had when we were working on the exchange during the 2011 legislature. Our intention was that employers would have the option for a defined contribution and employees would be able to purchase their plan of choice. And the administrative efficiency section written for small employers also is right on target for the way we hope things would be organized for employers to make contributions. And lastly, our members very much value the advice that they get from their agents in those cases where they need an agent, and they appreciate the flexibility to use agents inside the insurance exchange, depending on their comfort level. So AOI represents employers and employees who will actually have to use the exchange, and so it's very important to us that it not be overly complicated for people to use and that it not limit purchasers' choice, and that it be attractive to as wide a range of purchasers as possible. One of the things that I don't think we've talked about today much is that the market-based system right now is that you can purchase within or outside the exchange. And while that's what we want to have happen, we also want the exchange to be the most attractive vehicle possible so that people are drawn naturally to purchase inside of it. And it looks like that's the direction things are going right now. Thank you.
Chair? Yes, please. Hi, I noticed you point out that small businesses like the opportunity to use the agent. Do they also like the opportunity to save money by not using an agent and doing it themselves? I mean, do they mind paying extra to use an agent if it serves their needs?
Mr. Chair, I think that the issue for our members is, of course, the issue always has to do with cost, but some of them feel less comfortable making decisions on their own and have been very dependent on their agents. So while we haven't discussed a specific method of payment for that, they do appreciate the fact that they still have the ability to use those people if they feel that that's something they need to rely on.
Yeah, I guess just to follow up, I mean, my question, I understand that perfectly, but it seems to me some of your members would say, well, I don't need to use an agent, I just would not pay for it if I don't use it. I wonder whether that's been in your discussion at all.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlight, that's not, we haven't gotten that far into the agent discussion, so.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's as far as we've gone with it.
Anything else? Okay, next.
For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We have about 7,000 independent and small business members throughout the state of Oregon. And our average employer
has an employee base of less than 10. And that's not including the owner or owners. So we truly represent the small business market and that market that we hope the exchange will serve. I don't want to repeat what Betsy Earls has just communicated from AOI, but it does represent very much our same sentiment regarding the exchange. And the business plan that's been presented today, as we understand it, the elements that were mentioned that are important to small business, like defined contribution, simplicity of execution for our small business owners, not to be burdened by paperwork and administrative time and effort, is really very critical. The agent issue is also important to our small businesses. Insurance, as we all know, can be very complicated, and businesses have to carry more than just health insurance. There are other insurance that they have to carry as well, and they depend on their agents to help ferret through the complexity and the ever-changing landscape of insurance needs. So we do appreciate that that is included in the exchange at this time. And in response to your question, Representative Greenlick, we are the same. We know that agents are important to our small businesses. As far as the cost element to being able to use them within the exchange, that's something that we have not greatly delved into at this point. Obviously, cost is always a concern. And our vision for the exchange is that it creates a very robust marketplace and that it is a facilitator, not a regulator. And to that extent, we are very pleased with the work that has been done by Rocky King and Amy Faber and their staff. And we like the direction that the exchange is going today. And I'm open to any questions.
Representative Parrish?
Thank you. I do have a question because I wish I would have asked it earlier and hadn't thought to ask it, but it just popped in my head as you were, you know, talking about kind of the needs of your small businesses. I know from having been a small business and when you work through a single insurance agent for your auto and your life and for all the other plans, that a lot of times there is kind of an efficiency discount for bundling all of those services. Have any of your members expressed concern that if they pop healthcare into the exchange, that they kind of decouple some of the savings that they might get by when they bundle all those other insurance pieces together? And I'm curious if anybody has any sense of what, you know, what kind of percentage we're talking about when you take out something that has a fairly substantial cost out of that kind of pricing mix, and now you're just kind of left with, you know, maybe life insurance and car insurance and business liability insurance. When you take away the health insurance piece too, that there's actually potentially a cost there for your members, a loss of savings.
Sure. Co-Chair Thompson and Representative Parrish, that's a very, very good question. And as we hear often, devil is in the details, and that is a detail that certainly I would affect our small business members, but I don't think we've gotten that far along down the road yet, as the whole agent equation is still under discussion. But I will bring that question up, and that's a good one.
The other question, yes.
This isn't necessarily directed to the panel. Maybe just a source of confusion that someone can clarify for me. Aren't we required to have the same pricing for inside and outside the exchange? So why is the discussion of cost even relevant if we can't have a different cost for a policy inside or outside the exchange? I just don't understand why we're even discussing it.
Because we could use the question of an agent as a design characteristic, and you could have a design with and without agent support, which could be inside and outside for that. It's only inside and outside for exactly the same products sold by the same company.
I see. So you would mandate that there be a non-agent policy and an agent policy, and that would be a design characteristic that could carry with it an inside and outside price differential. Okay, I understand that. I mean, make a comment, Mr.
Please.
Chair.
Yes.
I've actually had to purchase insurance outside of a group before, and just for the sake of sharing that experience, it was enormously complex. And what I found out is that I don't know as much as I thought I knew about health insurance.
We all are.
And it was, and I'll be honest, I mean, I feel like, you know, I could have taken the time, probably, for me it would have been several months, for the average person maybe a week or two, to understand fully health insurance and the various products and what those things mean. It would have been very, very difficult. And just as I don't try to understand how my car works anymore, I think that we need intermediaries who have expertise who can provide information to consumers and to small businesses and to people who don't have that level of understanding.
If I may address Representative Co-Chair Thompson and Representative Conger, I think you have just verbalized what the majority of our small business members experience and why they feel that agents are important to have available if they want to. We hope that the way the exchange is going, that it will be a very desirable marketplace for our members and that they will not have to forego the benefit of having an agent, especially many of these have been with these companies for many, many years, and they're a very important consultant to their entire business operation, and they don't want to have that relationship cut.
Mr. Chair, if I might comment.
You certainly may.
Thank you. I think the issue is this. Most of the small employers, my impression is, in the exchange, will be moving into a divine contribution plan. So they don't have to figure out what their employees want. They'll come in and say, we'll pay $200 a month, and my employees can go pick out whichever plan they want and pay the difference. So, I mean, it's essentially changing the game, and that's why I keep asking about an agent. If you have 10 or 12 employees, an agent's fee could cost $5,000 or $6,000 a year. And I would imagine as a small businessman, if all I'm going to do is go in and pay $250 a month or whatever I'm going to pay, I don't want to pay an extra $5,000 a year for the use of an agent I don't need. And all I'm trying to do is to save the small businesses money if there's a way we can figure out how to do this so that if they do use a defined contribution, and I expect most of them will, they're not going to need an agent because they don't have to figure out which plan. I mean, it's going to be up to their employees. And they might be willing to pay $5,000 to have an agent help their employees figure it out because it is going to be complicated. But we would hope that the exchange will be simple enough in its model so that an employee can go in and figure out, is this worth $200 a month more? Is this worth $100 a month more than my boss is paying? And I think it changes the game over the game now where an employer has to say, do I take Kaiser? Do I take Regents? Here are the different rules. I mean, it is extraordinarily complicated now, and one hopes, and I think Rocky and Amy and their folks have done a great job. I mean, I think the hope is that this will be a game changer, and that's, you know, and I think agents ought to be there, but I think people ought to pay for them if they want to use an agent. I mean, it seems to me so simple. It seems to me your members ought to be saying, yeah, wait a minute, I don't want to pay extra money to use an agent if all I'm going to do is tell them, where do I send the check? And that's essentially what I think their issue is going to be in most cases.
Appreciate well.
I have to say my experience with healthcare and being on the healthcare committee in a small business and a manufacturing business, we had lots of different employees with lots of different skill sets that helped us make our product, but they were not experts in healthcare. So we had manufacturing employees. You know, my expertise is in international sales. That's what I spent my time doing so that we could get the product out the door. And I was on that healthcare committee on the board, so we looked at it. Having an agent helped us understand what we needed to do. And again, my employees were focused on getting the product out the door and weren't necessarily able to take the time or understand what the impacts were of the choices that they were making. Having an agent made it so that we could have our employees make the best choices possible. We can make those best choices possible because my expertise isn't in healthcare. And although I'm not a stupid person, I have an area of expertise, but again, wasn't healthcare. And you know, you have limited amount of time and ability. And right now, what I feel is that we have You know, again, so my experience was very similar to Representative Congers. And he's a Harvard-educated lawyer, you know. Not all of us have that benefit. But at the end of the day, I feel like we have an existing network.
Handicap, is it?
Yeah. We have an existing network that our small businesses are used to using. And the small businesses that I talk to have people that are doing three different jobs because they don't have the money to have extra capacity. And if we have an existing network that can help people transfer over to the exchange, there may be a point, and you may be right, that because this is simpler, there may be a point that agents aren't going to be used in the same way, much the way travel agents aren't used the same way. And any insurance agent that thinks that the landscape is going to stay the same will not be in business. So as business needs change, I think we change the system. But my concern is changing the system that our small businesses use currently to get their information, that the relationships that they have trust in, a means to get the best policies possible. If we break apart the system and the means to pay for it right now, I'm concerned that people will not be making the best choices possible, and that consumers, specifically those consumers that don't have the ability or the time or the means to access the best information, won't make the best choices. So I'm concerned about making those changes now, although Representative Greenlich, I certainly understand what you're saying.
Mr. Thompson. And very quickly, it's not only that to add on to what Representative Hoyle has, but it's things like enrollment. If you've never gone through and enrolled a lot of people or even four people in a health plan, that's something that an agent does help. And so between not just answering questions, but for the business person, making sure that enrollment and those kind of things are covered, because that can be very sometimes convoluted, and sometimes you enroll in something that you didn't realize that you did without that help. So
I think that's an important part of the discussion, at least in the initial phase, because it's probably true the employers may not use the agents very much because they'll be writing a check to the employee and end of story. Some of them will. Some of them will take more active interest. But, you know, in my own case, I don't know if I'm capable of understanding insurance or not. I don't want to. And I will go to my agent who handles all of my other insurance and say, what kind of a deal can you get for me as a starting point? If that agent is certified to work in the exchange, that's another good point. But it also opens the door to have a discussion about bundling. You know, I have so much money to spend on health insurance, and I have my house insurance, my car insurance, etc. Get me a good deal with this money I've got, looking at the exchange, looking at other options, looking at my overall insurance plan. And I think an agent can provide an opportunity to save money as well as cost money.
Well, we can share experience how agents helped us pick our PEP plan, right? How's your agent do helping you with that one?
I'm not on PEP.
Well, if you were, it would be, you made a decision to opt out, which was a decision you made without an agent's help. I mean, we all made decisions to opt in or opt out, to choose A or B, and we did it basically on our own without an agent, even though we're unable to understand health care, as we're saying here. It's a decision that you make, and it's relatively straightforward. And I hope the exchange will be easier than PEP. I mean, I hope PEP is an example to show how it can be even easier.
I don't think you picked a very good example.
Well, but the point is, we did not use agents to make that choice. Yeah. And if an agent had come to you and said, well, if you give me $500, I'll help you figure out your PEB choice, you might have done that. I mean, I call Alaska Airlines sometimes. They say, well, if we make the ticket, it's going to be $50 a ticket extra. Sometimes I choose that. Sometimes I go to the computer and choose it. And that's all I think small business people should want. I don't understand. I don't understand this notion. No, I want to pay the $5,000 without having a choice of whether I pay it or not. Okay.
Representative Boyle. I think my experience, and one of the things is an enrollment, again, pulling people off a manufacturing line to give them time to go through themselves, you know, all different options, and actually having someone go through, a low-wage worker, and go through and say, all right, if you take this $5,000 deductible and you're paying this much less money a month, which may be a choice between, I don't know, whatever, things that you need to buy. If you take that, here's what happens. Here's the impact if you actually have this kind of health outcome where, you know, again, and not everyone may have internet at home, not everyone may have the same kind of access. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think we're comparing apples to apples because it's not the same as buying a flight. It's, you know, thinking about, we had a lot of younger workers who absolutely thought they were invincible until, you know, they went headlong over their cyclocross bike and ended up in the emergency room and hospitalized. So it's those kinds of choices that it isn't a simple choice, and we do have the PEB plan is a great plan, and it covers a lot of things for not a lot of money, but not every business and not every person is going to have those opportunities.
My guess is, too, as we get into this, we're going to see a lot of change, obviously. But agents are going to show their value or they'll disappear. So if they aren't providing value to the system, no one will be using them down the line. So it's an opportunity and some risk as well. But it's just another avenue. Anyone else? Okay, I guess you're up here.
Thank you, Chair Thompson and Chair Greenlick and Committee. For the record, my name is Gail Evans. I'm Vice President of Human Resources for Unitas Community Credit Union in Portland. And I serve as Vice Chair of the Oregon Business Association's Health Policy Committee. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify today. And I'd also like to thank Rocky and Amy and the Health Exchange Board for all their hard work in developing the business plan to date. A few words about the Oregon Business Association. We were formed by a group of business leaders to provide bipartisan input on statewide issues that will support Oregon's continued success and economic competitiveness. OBA actively supported passage of Senate Bill 99 in the 2011 legislative session, and the Health Policy Committee of OBA formed a subcommittee to closely monitor both the Exchange Business Plan and Transformation Implementation Plan. We do support the Exchange in the direction of the business plan as we know it today. I would like to present 10 guiding principles developed by the OBA subcommittee for the Exchange, and I believe you have a copy of those in your handouts. Number one, the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange must provide a value proposition for employers and individuals. The proposition must be clear, achievable, and competitive. And by value proposition, we are referring to things including but not limited to employee choice, diverse provider networks, wellness support, accessibility, cost savings, and rate stability. Number two, the exchange should increase or should be transparent in measuring and reporting actual outcomes in relation to stated objectives. Number three, the exchange should be increased the number of covered lives and reverse the growing trend of cost shift to businesses and the private sector. Number four, the exchange should promote competition by offering employers and individuals a broad choice of high quality and reliable health plans and delivery systems. Number five, the exchange should be easy for employers and individuals to access and navigate and offer standardized resources and tools for objectively comparing insurance options inside and outside the exchange. Number six, the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Board and the Exchange Corporation should be held accountable for their results to the stakeholders and provide public outreach to ensure stakeholder involvement. The exchange should encourage those who purchase coverage through the exchange to be a diverse mix of Oregonians. Number eight, the exchange should be self-sustaining. Number nine, participation in the exchange should be voluntary. Employers who do enter the exchange should not be penalized by the state if they choose to terminate coverage through the exchange. And number 10, lastly, the exchange should be aligned with comprehensive health care reform in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We look forward to continuing to monitor the implementation of the exchange.
Any questions?
Yeah, do you mean on voluntary that if an employer enters the exchange, its employees shouldn't have to, they get their insurance through the employer some other way?
And as I understand it, the employer will have the option to make the exchange available to their employees through that voucher system. If they should do that and the exchange does not deliver on the value proposition, there should be an exit strategy that does not penalize the employer.
An exit strategy for the employee?
Yeah, the employer and their employees who may be participating.
But are you saying that I have 10 employees, I go into the exchange with a defined contribution, and 9 of them go in and one says, no, I want you to buy my health insurance some other way. They ought to be, the employer ought to be required to do that? Is that here?
The employer may not sponsor employee participation in the exchange. So the thinking on the subcommittee is if the employer no longer wants to participate in the exchange, that they would not be penalized for that.
But my question is not about whether the employer does, but whether the employee is voluntary. Is the voluntary thing only on the employer, not on the employee?
We did not discuss that as a committee. That's a great question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything else?
Chaotic.
Thank you. Okay, last but not least.
Hi, Co-Chair Thompson and Representative Greenlink and members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the healthcare advocate at OSPIRC, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify before you today. OSPIRC is a nonprofit, nonpartisan consumer organization with members across the state. Oregon's exchange has the potential to help improve quality and reduce costs for consumers and small businesses, and it comes at a really important time. According to a recent Commonwealth report that was released in about the middle of November, it showed that for Oregon, the average premium for employer-based coverage, family coverage, climbed about 55% between 2003 and 2010. And during that same time, that deductibles rose about 148%. So we're seeing the numbers bear out a lot what ordinary consumers and small businesses are saying, which is, I pay more and more and I get less and less. At the same time, we're seeing that trend keep going. Recently, we reviewed a rate filing in which some of the small employer-based family plans had premiums exceeding $2,000 a month. So this is these are hard times, and in this economy, it's really tough. We all know we need to cut costs, not by cutting care, but actually doing care better, cutting waste, improving efficiency, and actually helping people stay healthier. And we think that the exchange has an opportunity to play a really important part in this, together with other components to reform our healthcare system. But we think it's important for that to be done right. We're encouraged by the direction so far of the exchange in Oregon. And just have a couple comments on that. We think the exchange should be a competitive marketplace, that really the exchange's role is one as a market strategy that leverages buying power essentially to help drive the types of changes in the system that can lower prices and improve quality. We're happy to see that the business plan that was approved last week includes a number of important elements heading in that direction, such as tools for consumers to compare plans, including things like cost calculators, where you can actually compare, okay, what's the difference between this higher premium or having a higher deductible? What is that real difference? What's the risk left for me? And other tools that can help people compare plans apples to apples. In addition to that, the plan also envisions setting quality standards and rankings consistent with other pieces of trying to fix the healthcare system, so consistent with standards that are developed through the transformation process. And as Gail just mentioned, it makes sense for this to be for the exchange to be aligned with other efforts to fix our healthcare system, so that we're essentially all the oars are in the water and all pulling at the same time toward the same goal. At Osberg, we'll continue to monitor the exchange's process in the year ahead as the board fleshes out the details of this plan. I think someone already mentioned that the devil's in the details, and that's certainly the case here. Looking ahead toward those details, we've recently joined together with over a dozen groups to send recommendations to the exchange board and leadership, outlining some key priorities as a lot of those details get pulled together, and I've included a copy of those recommendations along with the text. In order for the exchange to succeed, I think it's really important for the exchange to actually be attractive to consumers, for it to have that value proposition. And we continue to recommend that the exchange offer consumers the very best deals. That means the best plans at the best price. And in addition to setting standards, the exchange can help to do that by acting like a business itself and leveraging the buying power of enrollees to negotiate a better deal, much like businesses do now, much like business associations do now. We're encouraged by the board's direction of the exchange, the board's direction to the exchange at this relatively sort of early stage in the process. There are a lot of details to come. We'll continue closely monitoring the exchange as the details take shape and continue advocating for specific details to make sure that this can deliver for Oregon consumers and small businesses. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Yeah. Thank you. And. Thank all of you. We will move on. Okay, we will close the informational hearing and we will open a public hearing on LC 164, LC 165, LC 167, and LC 168. We have testimony on those bills. I would ask you to keep it very, very short. We'll be coming back to these in February anyway, don't we? Yeah, we'll be coming back to these in February, so they don't become law today. Everybody keep a relaxed attitude. Okay, first up is LC 164. We have Ed Conlow and Thomas King.
Appreciate the opportunity. My name is Ed Conlon, I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Imaging, and with me is Thomas King, the Chair of our Board. I wanted to spend a couple minutes addressing the committee on LC 164. A little background, this legislation is intended to make a couple corrections to legislation that was enacted in 2009 when HB 2245 expanded the number of medical imaging professionals who had to be licensed in Oregon. It also placed a mandate that stated that everyone, all medical imaging licensees needed to have a national credential by 2014. In the process of the last couple months, we've run into a couple situations of small groups that seem to have fallen through the cracks, and we're asking the committee to work with us, and LC 164 will allow us to keep those folks licensed. The first group is provisional license holders. When the legislation kicked in July 1, 2010, there was some folks out there, some professionals who had no license. The board decided to issue provisional licenses and say, okay, you can do your work. We're not going to stop you from working, but by 2014, this is a red flag. You have to get this national credential. That's what the provisional license is about. What we didn't realize until it was pointed out by our legal counsel in July was that there was a requirement in the current law that that requires these folks to have all graduated from a medical imaging school. Not all of them have. We were not aware of it. We think it might have been an error somewhere in the legislative process. It doesn't make sense in the context of the bill, of the 2009 law. So we're asking, one part of the bill will allow us to renew a small number of licenses that will come due before 2014 for some individuals who are out there practicing, competent, good work, hard-working medical imaging professionals who, without this legislation, we cannot renew their license before 2014. That's one part of the bill. Another part of the bill there's a couple small groups, state-sponsored license holders, some individuals who over the course of years, the board has, for one reason or another, they would allow them to take a national credentialing examination under state sponsorship. What we find out going forward is the National Registry will not recognize this state sponsorship in 2014. I suspect as this legislation was being worked on in 2009, this folks probably assumed that this group would be ushered through.
To summarize rather quickly for us? You'll be able to do it again in February anyway, so we just need just what the bill is intended to do in brief format.
Provisional license holders, state-sponsored license holders, and grandfathered radiographers, this legislation allows us to keep them working, keep renewing their license, even though they kind of fall through the cracks.
So basically a fix on some of the legislation. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Chair Thompson, basically Ed said everything I need to say, unless there's any questions, okay. I'm here to support.
Are there any questions at this point? The budget. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
We will move on to LC 165. And that will be Holly Mercer and Wendy. Again, if you just give us a brief. What are we trying to do here? Because
yes,
we're
going
to be back on this in February. So,
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Holly Mercer. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing in Oregon. In 2009, we passed House Bill 2345 that combined the Health Professional Services Program for Impaired Professionals into one entity. The four boards involved are medical, nursing, dental, and pharmacy. What we're doing with this bill is to take out a piece of the system that we thought would work and we found that it didn't work. The piece of the system is this. You can enter this program two ways, as a board referred, which comes through as a complaint, or as self-referred that stays anonymous to the board. And the challenge of 2345 was that if that self-referred participant, a healthcare professional licensee, is non-compliant, will the board be given that information? The challenge comes if that licensee revokes their consent. And we put in place what's called the monitoring entity. And I've on page two of your handouts, I've tried to draw a little schematic of the way this works. And what we are proposing in this bill is to put a red line through the monitoring entity. We no longer need it. We found out that when a self-referred licensee revokes their consent to give the board information, the boards have to go to circuit court to get that information. We tried to find another solution to that. We tried to put this entity in there that had at least the licensee's name, that when they were non-compliant, that that name would be given to the board. The attorneys for the monitoring entity, upon further review, said, no, we feel that you have to go to circuit court. Circuit court said, no, we're not going to give you the name of the licensee, which is concerning at another level, but for the purposes of this bill, all we're asking this committee to do is delete the monitoring entity. It is streamlining. It saves the four boards combined close to $200,000. It saves the Board of Nursing $115,000 in a biennium. We have the support of the Medical Board, the Dental Board, the Pharmacy Board, the Nursing Board, and the ONA. And to my right is a representative from the Oregon Medical Association that had some concerns, but we feel they're workable, and we feel that we strongly support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Chairs Greenlick and Thompson, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel with the Oregon Medical Association, and we do support this bill. But we have just a quick technical fix that we hope you'll consider. With the removal of the monitoring entity, which we support, there were also some protections in existing law that were removed. Under existing law, the report from a monitoring entity to the boards about who's enrolled in the program and who successfully completed it is protected from the public records law, and anybody that self-referred is not included in that report. The idea is that we want people to self-refer before they come to the attention of the board, and we want to protect those people going into the program and make sure they feel that their participation is confidential. So that those weekly reports to the board didn't include the self-referreds. With the removal of the monitoring entity, those protections were also removed, and we would just like to see them inserted into the bill because they're reflective of the policy that was passed by this legislature in the original legislations. And we're glad to help with that fix as the committee directs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. There is still a monitoring agency. We ended up somehow with two monitoring agencies, which was never intended in this bill.
Quite astonishing that this body would have passed out legislation that wasn't quite right.
I hear it happened again in the last century.
Gently now.
Okay, anything else? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we will move on to LC 165. Oh, 167, I'm sorry. Getting ahead of myself here. Too many stacks in front of me. LC 167, and there'll be Susan King and Brian Blaringer. Again, if you just give us the very briefest, we're running out of time in a hurry, and I'm sure we'll have more to do with this in February. Just count on it.
Good morning, Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. I'm Susan King, Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association. Very briefly, this bill or this proposal attempts to correct one of the many inequities and inconsistency that exists currently in provider reimbursement for healthcare services by requiring that our members, nurse practitioners, be paid the same as determined by diagnostic procedure and treatment codes that are defined objectively and are nationally standardized.
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, Brian Behringer with the Oregon Medical Association. I will be extremely brief. You have our written comments, and I will just say that we absolutely want to support our nursing colleagues in this, and we've reached out to them. We believe the LC isn't quite there for us right now, and so we have reached out with them to them and are working with them and want to continue to work with them to see if we can't come to a compromise.
Very good. Are there any questions? We'll see you in February.
Thanks.
LC 168 is a bill that's a technical fix that puts in place an intermediate step where we have a working group working with the DUII restructuring for Oregon that will come up in 2013, we hope. This bill just makes a technical fix to the program so that we can move forward in the short run. I understand Amy Joyce is here. Again, if you just briefly.
Chairs Thompson and Greenlick and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, handing out written testimony. But as Chair Thompson indicated, this is a technical fix. DMV has an administrative rule that DOJ has called into question whether we have a statutory authority to do that. The bill would do three things: provide clear statutory authority for the requirement, And that requirement is that when a person who's been convicted of DUII comes into DMV to get their driver license reinstated, that they have to show proof that they've completed the DHS-approved drug or alcohol treatment that is required by statute for anyone convicted of DUII. So again, the bill does three things: gives clear statutory authority, gives DMV the ability to grant good cause exceptions, which will be written by rule, and thirdly, sunsets that authority in 2014, and we are participating in Rep. Thompson's work group that's looking holistically at the DUI system, and that's what the LC does.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just a brief comment. I had a constituent who was worried that he had completed a much more comprehensive course than in another state than this, and that wasn't sufficient for him to get it. I hope as a part of the bigger process we'll try and expand that range of what qualifies as a...
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, yes, I believe so, and to that specifically, the exceptions process that's provided for in the LC would address situations like that, Representative Greenlick, where folks have done things that are somewhat outside the typical situation, but certainly meet the goal of folks who have drug and alcohol problems of getting those treated.
Yeah, he did a 28-day stay at Hazleton in Minneapolis, and that seemed like it should have sufficed.
Nothing else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 164, 165, 167, and 168. And we will open a work session on LC 164, 165, 167, 168, and 286. There's a departure there, because 286 is the exact wording, punctuation, everything of LC 97, which we heard earlier with Mr. Bonetto. So we're just moving these to committee bills at this point. And Mr. Co-Chair, would you like to make the motion? Oh, you have it, okay.
Do I have a
right motion?
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, I move LC 164, dated 1/4/12, LC 165, dated 12/20/11, LC 167, dated 12/16/11, LC 168, dated 12/20/11, LC 286, dated 1/13/12, be introduced as committee bills.
Chair Greenlick has moved that LC 164, dated 1/4/12, LC 165, dated 1/20/11, LC 167, dated 12/16/11, LC 168, dated 12/20/11, and LC 286, dated 1/13/12, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? If there is no objection, I think we can accept these by consensus. So done. And that leaves us, my friends, at the end of our session. And we made it. For having been miserably behind at the beginning, we pulled it out. I want to thank you all. With that, I am going to adjourn. House Interim Health Committee.